So that was the thing that just happened.
Figuring Dan's favorite song, 99 Problems, but a Bith Ain't One. I never said I made good jokes.
And you were making fun of his cheese puns earlier.
Hey, you'd already got a like. From Z.
Oh, God
damn it.
I got to go home to that. Damn.
Yep.
Oh, damn.
Can you file for divorce over Facebook? I'm just wondering.
Probably now. Yeah, probably.
Welcome to Preferred Enemies, the Undercover Network Warhammer 40K podcast. I'm your host, Rob.
Kevin.
Dennis.
And Richard.
And this is episode number 118, in which we will be continuing the series of So You Want to Start an Army, and today we'll be moving on to Tyranids. We're kind of starting at the bottom of the letters. We did Tau, we're doing Tyranids. Eventually we'll work our way up to A with Adeptus Mechanicus.
Yay.
Unless we stop at S for Skitarii.
Right. Well, We may get a new codex before then. So
yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
But before we get into that, very brief news. Again, not much released 40K-wise. They're on It's Another Age of Sigmar month with Fiery Dwarves being released. But there is a little bit of something of interest from Games Workshop. They are apparently hiring a rules writer.
Oh, they finally need one.
That looked very interesting. I mean, need to for 40K, Age of Sigmar, and box games.
Yes, specialist games are officially a department once again. Yep. They don't have anything out yet. There's various mixed rumors about what the first game could be. We won't get into those because of our standard rumors policy. But, yeah, so I'm thinking, yeah, if somebody to help on the rules team. I think having somebody maybe working on FAQs would be good, but if they've got somebody that they want to have write for the boxed games too, it just means they don't want to spread themselves too thin.
It also said be ready to work on tight deadlines.
Ooh.
So that makes me think they're going to be still cranking things out.
Oh, I don't think if they're releasing like new Sigmar stuff every week. And no, although, you know, you've got to wonder like what the lead time is between the model is done when they get the rules done. But like with Sigmar, considering they can release the rules in White Dwarf and PDF download like as soon as the unit's up, although they have to have the rules that they're also printed in the box generally, aren't they?
I think so. I haven't picked up any.
Yeah, I don't pick up Sigmar stuff, but yeah. I believe they're supposed to be in the box, so there'd be a little bit of a lead time.
And they've got
there.
Like the little app as well that you can go and download the war scrolls and stuff. So yeah. there's a lot of different ways for them to get that stuff out there.
Yeah, I'd say the only negative about the job is we'd have to relocate.
Yeah. No.
No, I mean, can work remotely.
No, they want you there in Nottingham.
No, yeah. I only work remotely.
Well, sorry.
I don't think they're going to hire you.
Damn.
I don't think they would have hired you anyway, but that's beside the point. We love you.
Just
so that's really the only news from GW. The couple of other things of note. There is a podcast that is returning from the dead.
Yeah.
The independent characters have officially announced that their indefinite hiatus is in fact indefinite and will be ending in March when they come back with new episodes.
So they made their Necron save to bring back.
Yes, they'll be back. And yeah, Carl couldn't stay away. Just couldn't stay away from the sweet, sweet podcasting game.
Yep.
Yeah.
All that cold hard cash he's making.
Yeah, how do you think he affords to spend Carl's at Forge World? And he's already like started painting new stuff, and yeah, so it's, I mean, they're getting fully active once again.
No, that's great.
Also, a game that we've mentioned a few times in the past, Eternal Crusade, is finally coming out of the foggy realms of founders only play and is moving to
Steam Early Access.
Yes. The wretched hive of scum and villainy that is Steam Early Access.
Yay. Yeah, the last one. Yay? Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. But, you know.
But they've released like a full FAQ on why they're doing what they're doing, and
like it does seem like it's a step towards actually finalizing the game, because it's not just an Eternal Crusade in Eternal Beta. This is like a step towards, just another step towards release is what it seems like to me.
And from the way they describe everything, they've got like a 10-year plan to get everything released.
It really sounded like they were treating it like an MMO type schedule.
Yeah.
Well, what they were going to do for releases.
It's basically, it's an MMO FPS. It's kind of a Planet Strike style.
Yeah, kind
of. Or Planet Side. That's the one I'm thinking of. Planet Strike is a 40K thing. But this is also a 40K thing, but Planet Side is not. But yeah, it's basically like a persistent shooter for all intents and purposes. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with that. Right now, Founders can get in for $40. Don't know what the early access price is going to be, but I imagine it'll have to be a little bit higher. The Founders will be very pissed.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I would imagine so. I'm guessing it's probably going to be like 50.
Yeah, just a little bit more, but not quite like AAA game release cost of $60. So,
yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how that actually pans out, and because I think right now they only have like Imperium and Chaos, like Space Marines and Chaos, functional.
Yeah,
Orcs and Eldar are still yet to come.
They said the animations for them were hard to get the rigging right for.
Yeah,
and I think they said they were outsourcing a lot of those as well.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to play Eldar anyway.
Dude, that's all I would play. Well, I might try Orcs out.
And they are also working on like the Tyranids as enemy models.
Right.
But yeah, they're still a little ways off on those too, I think.
It'll be interesting to see. There's just a glut of 40K because we've talked about Inquisitor Martyr, which is getting closer and closer. Battlefield Gothic Armada is coming closer, getting closer and closer to release. So we are definitely in, I don't know if I'd say the golden age, but maybe silver age of 40K game releases.
Video game age.
Yeah.
I actually got a chance to play Vermintide.
How is it?
It's pretty fun. I mean, the description of it is Left 4 Dead, but you're shooting Skaven is really accurate.
That's awesome.
It plays an awful lot like Left 4 Dead.
Well, the game format is tested and true, so
yes.
If you can make it look good and have the right feel to it.
Yep.
And I remember it's like branded as Warhammer End Times Vermintide. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and in fact, I think somebody, I remember seeing something, I think it may have been on Bell of Lost Souls, that it was either that or Fate 212, where somebody like wrote into a Games Workshop store and said, hey, my son and I want to come up there, but we want to play Warhammer Fantasy. Are we still allowed to do that? Because they don't generally allow you to play games that aren't GW games, and the store basically said, yeah, you can still play Warhammer Fantasy here. That's fine.
Still a GW game, yeah.
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 Because I think they probably still allow people to play Blood Bowl up there. Just can't buy anything new.
Right.
Yeah, Blood Bowl, yet another game that has been named as a possible specialist game release. But anyway, so that pretty much wraps us up for news. Like I said, it's a very brief segment.
Right.
So we're going to go ahead and move on to rules questions. As always, our rules questions are generated by you, the listeners. And my goodness, you guys went above and beyond.
Guys are burning the midnight oil on this one.
Yeah.
They're just questioning us.
And
come on. Bah,
bah, bah, bah. Okay, so thanks for derailing that, Dennis.
oh, my pleasure.
You're a master.
At chaos.
But anyway, so you guys have thrown a ton of rules questions and some really good ones, too. But before we get into the list of rules questions and our attempt to start answering them, we do have a clarification/correction from our last episode. Last episode, we had a question from Tony Thibault that was about whether or not you could take a chapter master in a demi battle, like a battle demi company, because it says a captain or a chaplain, and technically a chapter master is an upgrade to a captain. So we said, yeah, you probably could. However, Richard did a little bit of research on one of our examples that we used and had some more feedback on
because,
that.
Yes, the brother captain data sheet is what we compared it to, as the grandmaster is also an upgrade from the brother captain. So they're on the same data sheet. One's an upgrade from another. But if you actually go and look at the Grey Knight Brotherhood formation in that codex, it actually specifically calls for a Grand Master and a Brother Captain. And like the Grand Master is also specified in some of the other rules, like as long as he's still alive, such and such, these rules apply. So there seems to be an actual distinction between those two units, even though they come from the same data sheet.
Now, on the flip side of that, just as a kind of like devil's advocate, I know that like sometimes in the formations, they do specifically like call out that like restrictions, like one must be upgraded to this, or, you know, like the one I'm thinking of is I want to say there's like a Tech Marine formation and one of them has to be upgraded to Master of the Forge. You know,
But again,
like specifically like, oh, it's, or, you know, Librarius Conclave, it's Dean's ones, but it specifically could be, you know, one with this or something.
Right. Or the Space Marine starter box actually specifies must be a captain in Terminator.
So they do put restrictions
on that. And that's not something that's actually listed in the formation as a restriction. Mm-hmm. The Captain in Terminator armor is just literally the name that it lists.
Because they did the same thing on the Tau formation we talked about last episode, where it's ethereal on a hover drone.
Right.
You know, so it does make me wonder if specific to the formations. I mean, and granted, yeah, we're still talking about a formation where, you know, specifically says captain instead of, you know, chapter master. But it does make me wonder if the distinction is just kind of in that formation. You know, like for that specific one that you have to take two and one has to be upgraded to this or something.
Right.
I don't know. There's interesting rules
because, yeah, like the actual wording on it, like, doesn't say anything about like upgrading or anything. It literally just says you need a Grandmaster,
right,
and you need a Brother Captain.
Yeah. So with that in mind, I would say I would actually probably revise the answer, especially because, as we pointed out, that you can't swap for any of the named Chapter Master characters. So with that evidence and the evidence from the Grey Knight Codex, I would say revise that and say, yeah, you probably cannot take a Chapter Master, like a generic Chapter Master, in a Battle Demi company. Again, that's a question for, you know, if you ever have a conflict, you know, at a tournament, talk to your TO. If it's just a friendly game, you know, talk it out, but I think the evidence kind of leans towards that we were incorrect, and that you would not be allowed to take a Chapter Master captain.
Yeah,
basically. So moving on. But before I get to those rules questions, I have to get out the stack of books that I have to reference. Let me drag it over, set it on the table. Because you guys came up with questions from all over the place, and even referencing books that we don't have on premises, but we have access. There we go.
Ooh, yep.
Did you hear that? That's the stack of books for your rules questions, and the tiny rule book. That's not even the main rule book. The tiny rule book is what I'm using. This is just the stack of code. Oh wait, I forgot one. We even have Imperial Armor Apocalypse.
Oh wow.
There we go.
I'm just happy this table is sturdy.
Right. Yeah. So am I. Because my laptop's on here.
Well, Dennis
not being attacked by beer this time.
Dennis has his Eldar army on this table. If this thing collapsed, he would probably be upset.
Yeah, he might be just a little bit.
Yeah, but they're flyers. They could just fly through the air with the greatest of ease.
That's how that works.
Oh.
All right.
They could use the Force.
It's not how this works. It's how the Force works. How any of this works?
I'm unfriending you.
Now you'll be enemies.
All right, preferred enemies.
Exactly.
You know, I was thinking about something that I came up in my talk with the guys from Life After the Cover Save. They're asking what our listeners were referred to, because they have like lifers, and there, you know, other shows have had, you know, like the, you know, 40K Radio had the freebooters and things like that. And so we were like, well, preferred fans. And so I thought of one, preferred frenemies. But it turns out there's actually a preferred frenemies blog on Blogspot.
Oh, wow.
So it's already taken. Sorry. You know what? You guys want to come up with a name?
Yeah.
Go ahead and leave a comment on the post for this episode and let us know what you think you guys as listeners should be called.
Yeah.
Other than listeners.
I mean, you're already listening.
Snazzy name.
Yeah. Come up with something with jazz hands on it. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah,
they can't hear you jazz handsing.
And no, they
can shake my hands hard enough,
they can hear it in spirit.
All right, okay. So what I'm going to do? We've got like a list. The list is like 7 pages long.
Yeah,
I don't think we're going to get through all of them. So what we're going to do? I'm going to set a 45-minute timer. Now, that's 45 minutes of our time. I'll try to pause it when I can. You know, if we have to, like, do a lot of lookup. So we'll try to get it close to 45 minutes your time, but it may not be exactly one for one just because of the editing process. I apologize for that. But I mean, got the first book out that's required. There we go. Got it turned on. And ready? Here we go. All right, first question is from Robert Bomer. Robert Bomer writes, "Rules aficionados, lend me your ears. I had a thought, and it seems amazing, but I've never heard it mentioned before, so I may be making chicken salad out of chicken crap," which is a great statement. I just want to throw that out there. "So feel free to crush my dreams." "In the Angels Fury Spearhead Force formation, Augur Triangulation says that deep strike reserves within 12 inches of two units with teleport homers don't scatter and can assault the turn they came in. The Storm Ravens Skies of Fury rule deploys an embarked squad as if it were deep striking. Deep striking says, in order for a unit to deep strike, all models must have the deep strike special rule and must start the game in reserve. So would units being deployed via Skies of Fury be able to benefit from Augur triangulations? Seems a unit being treated as if it were deep striking would be treated as if it were coming from deep strike reserve." And I'm just going to come out here and say, I think that, yes, that would be correct. Because deep strike and deep strike reserve are pretty much considered analogous.
Yeah.
Anything that it enters play via deep strike acts as if it was in deep strike reserve.
And anything that starts on the game, not on the table, is
in reserve. Yeah.
Yeah. And flyers have to start in reserve. So, you know, barring like anything like a sky shield.
Right.
So I would say yes, because the rules say they act as if they're deep striking, they would act for all intents and purposes. The only difference is instead of dealing with deep strike mishaps, they're either they either scatter or they're destroyed. But
right.
Yeah, I think it makes sense.
So yeah, I would say if they're within if you drop them off within 12 inches of two of those units. I mean, you've got to get your flight plan and your flight path just right to you kind of thread the needle there. But because it would be based on where you drop them off along the path of the Storm Raven's flight.
Yeah.
But as long as that spot where you drop them is within 12 inches of two of those units, then yeah, you would be fine.
I mean, and just from a fluff perspective, that would make sense, because with the Augur triangulation, you're basically controlling where stuff lands from orbit. If they're just falling from low orbit, you know, or atmosphere, yeah, it would work the same way.
Yeah. I mean, to get into a counter fluff argument, technically they're teleport homers and not locator beacons, but again, game rules wise, they function pretty much identically. So I would allow it. I think they should work together.
Yeah, and the rules really don't make any distinction between actually deep striking and teleporting and
right.
That yeah.
And also consider that to pull this off, you would have to have not just the Angels Fury Spearhead Force, which is already three Storm Ravens and three tactical squads. You would have to have another Storm Ravens worth of guys that you're dropping off to assault with. So this is not something that's going to be cheap or easy to pull off.
Right.
But once you get it done,
points-wise or dollar-wise.
Right. And it does have to specifically be a Blood Angels unit to use the Augur triangulation. That's the other thing on that. But yeah, sir, I don't see why you couldn't do it. All right, moving on to the next question. Let's see. We got 41 minutes left to go. All right. Cody Gann writes, "Hey, guys, rules question for you has two parts. First, if a unit has infiltrate, does that unit have to infiltrate? Second, can a unit with the infiltrate special rule be deployed in a transport if the transport does not have the infiltrate special rule and is not a dedicated transport for the unit with infiltrate? By the way, I told the TO that podcast trumps TO, but then I realized I was talking to myself. Thanks." First of all, it's TO trumps podcast, but I love the idea of you trying to boost us up there, but thanks. So first, to answer your first question, does a unit with infiltrate have to infiltrate? Technically, if you have the infiltrate rule, it does say that a unit containing at least one model with a special rule is deployed last, and there's nothing that says it is optional. However, that doesn't mean you have to deploy it outside of your deployment zone.
Right. You can set them anywhere up on the table.
But technically, if you have infiltrators, if you have a unit with infiltrate, it has to deploy last. So and it just changes when it's deployed, but there's nothing saying that you have to.
That changes the fact that it then can't assault on the first turn.
Oh, if a unit that deploys with these rules cannot charge the first turn. Yeah, you're right.
Right. But most things
can't.
Aren't going to do that anyway, especially if you're not actually infiltrating them forward.
Right.
If you're deploying them in your deployment zone.
Right.
Or you could just outflank them right. and just forget about this whole mess.
Right. Well, and here's the thing. Like, but, as know, far as, let's say it, that I had a unit of infiltrators. So stealth suits, they have infiltrate, right?
Yes.
So let's say I just had a unit of those and I wanted, you know, didn't want to scout them, for, you know, infiltrate them forward. Just being able to deploy them on the table last, after I go first, I deploy my army. You deploy your army, and then I get to choose where to put my stealth suits, and that could be just deploying them in my own deployment zone. That's an advantage that I think you'd want to take.
Yeah.
Just the tactical flexibility no matter what, because it doesn't really change anything. Like, it just allows you to...
I'll choose to go first. My whole army has infiltrate. I'm done deploying.
Right.
Now you go.
You deploy, then I get to counter-deploy. Yeah, and still go first.
And I still get to go first, as long as you don't seize.
Right.
Right. And now, just okay, because I guess what threw me off when I was originally first considering this, because originally I was going to say, oh, yeah, you don't have to infiltrate if you don't want to.
I think we're all of that opinion when we first got into it before reading the rules.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Is that there are units like, infiltrate also grants outflank. So you can choose to put them in reserves and outflank them. Or if they're like stealth suits, as you mentioned before, they hit their jetpack, which means they have deep strike, which means you could choose to deep strike them, in which case infiltrate really wouldn't come into play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, if a unit like let's say you've got a scout squad.
Technically, if they have infiltrate and you're deciding to put them on the table during first turn, technically they'd be using the infiltrate rules.
Right.
Yeah. So
regardless of where you put them.
And it's one of those where even if it actually was an option, because I mean it does specifically say in here that units have to be deployed this way. But even if you could choose not to use infiltrate, I don't know why you wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because it just gives you that opportunity to deploy.
The only
reason
you wouldn't would be to have the charge.
Yeah, but like you said, if you're putting them in your own deployment zone, you're not getting that charge first turn one anyway.
You're likely not.
Likely not. But I mean, the opponent could be rushing at you, enough. And then you could counter charge them to make sure Khorne doesn't get all those extra attacks.
True.
Now, as to the second question, can a unit that has infiltrate be put in a non-dedicated transport, and specifically a non-dedicated transport without infiltrate? Yes, you absolutely could, because when you put them in the transport, now it's not the unit with infiltrate that you're deploying. You're deploying the transport.
Right.
Basically, once it's in a transport, it's kind of off the board. And even though the infiltrate rules specifically talk about the dedicated transport, that just says that if the unit has infiltrate and they have a dedicated transport, they kind of confer infiltrate to the dedicated transport. If they don't have a dedicated transport and you put them in a transport, it does not confer, and thus you would have to place the dedicated or the non-dedicated transport during your normal deployment or place in reserves.
Right. So there you go. There's your way around it. Is instead of to get that first turn charge for the infiltrators, you have to put them in an assault vehicle that doesn't have infiltrate, that's not dedicated to them.
Yeah, actually,
and then they can hop out of the vehicle and assault.
How the deployment rule works, they would still be infiltrating.
No, because it says a unit that deploys using these rules cannot charge in their first turn.
Right,
but if if you've placed them in a transport,
but if it's not a dedicated transport, they're technically deployed in the transport at deployment phase, because under deployment on the third paragraph there. Models can be deployed inside buildings, fortifications, or transport vehicles in their deployment zone subject to the transport capacity.
But if you're deploying the vehicle, you're not deploying the unit using the infiltrate rules.
Yeah.
The unit that's not on a dedicated transport isn't in the vehicle yet, because you can only start off the board technically inside a dedicated transport. Anytime you have another unit that is on a transport that's not dedicated, they're technically getting deployed into the transport at deployment phase.
True. But I think the fact that you'd be deploying it inside a non-dedicated transport would then break it out of the infiltrate cycle, because...
Well, technically, yes, because it's then in your deployment zone, and you can't charge with it anyway. So all of that becomes a moot point.
Well, again, if you could deploy
if it's an assault vehicle, I deploy
a unit of
scouts and a land raider.
Scouts and a land raider, I should be able to assault with them because I didn't make use of the infiltrate rules.
Technically, if they had infiltrate, you're always making use of the infiltrate rules.
Okay, I see what you're saying, that you deploy them
you're
in...
still, yeah, you'd... So the Land Raider would show up, and then at the infiltrate phase,
the scouts would
magically, like, boink into the Land Raider.
Yeah, because they were lying there in wait all along.
I'm just going to say that
if
you're putting scouts in a Land Raider to get a turn one assault, you're probably doing something wrong anyway.
Yeah. Well, yes, but it's... That's not the actual...
I know. It's not the actual point of what we're talking about.
I didn't say it was a good idea. It was just an example as to how something might happen that way.
Well, I would say check out the...
Well, I mean, okay, so I guess my other question is, like, we've talked about before that if an entire unit isn't made up of, you know, something like the formation rules or some of these other rules, like if the whole unit has to have it, you put a character in there that breaks that and the unit doesn't have that rule anymore, then it loses that ability. Would this be one of those where putting them in a non-dedicated transport
that
causes them to lose
infiltrate?
Because, I mean, there are other examples of rules where... Well, there are other examples of rules where like, fleet or something like that.
This question's easy. We'll just flip.
I still say it's a moot point unless you're putting scouts in a Land Raider.
Well, right.
I don't know what Dark Eldar thing has infiltrate, and do you have open top stuff in that?
Duh.
Do witches have infiltrate?
No.
Incubi have it, right?
Made them useful.
Incubi and a...
No.
Like...
The mandrakes do.
Ooh, mandrakes.
Mandrakes. Ooh, mandrakes, because everybody uses mandrakes.
Hey, mandrakes aren't as terrible as they used to be.
They look really cool.
They do look really cool.
The models are nice.
They're not as terrible as they used to be.
Oh, right. Okay, well, what Eldar thing has infiltrate?
Eldar don't have assault vehicles.
Yes,
but they're brothers, battle brothers with Dark Eldar who have assault vehicles.
The scouts.
Okay, here's my argument. Okay, here's my argument why you deploy the vehicle, the non-dedicated transport with the unit in it when you choose to deploy the vehicle. Because if you couldn't, you could never join a unit that had an independent character into a non-dedicated transport. And the reason is you can begin the game already with a unit either by being deployed in your coherency with it or in unit coherency with it, or if the unit's in reserve by you informing the opponent of which unit is joined. Being in a vehicle is neither of those things. You're not in coherency with the unit and you're not in reserve with the unit. So theoretically, you could never attach an independent character to a unit inside a vehicle if you had to deploy them inside the vehicle. So I would say that would be the argument for... You have to be able to place the unit inside the vehicle at the time you're deploying the vehicle.
Sounds to me like you're saying independent characters can't be in a dedicated transport.
That's all I heard.
Sorry. No, I would agree with you. I would think that you'd deploy it in the vehicle, and then since it's not specifically a dedicated transport, that unit basically loses infiltrate.
Dennis is coming from, that models can be deployed in transport vehicles. But I don't think that necessarily means you place the vehicle and then you deploy the unit inside of it.
Right, because we all just put it down at the same time.
Right, so I would say in that case you could have a unit that is that has the infiltrate USR, but by putting it in a vehicle that isn't dedicated, it loses the benefit of infiltrate.
And thus the downside.
And thus it is not placed according to the infiltrate rules. That would be the way around it.
Right, mm-hmm. And thus not subject to the limitations of infiltrate.
I still say it would be based on saying you have to infiltrate. But at the same time, if you are assaulting with a scout unit on turn one... I think something's wrong anyway.
Right.
So, Cody, there's our answer. We don't have one. No. There's our answer. Three of us agree.
If you say you outflank something, are they then...
Well, you couldn't assault...
They have the infiltrate special rule, and then you deploy them, but you're deploying them a different way.
But if you're outflanking them, you can't put them on a non-dedicated transport.
Right, because to do that... Yeah, to have them in a vehicle has to be a dedicated transport to gain outflank.
Right, but regardless of... Well, they can't
they can't assault out of reserves anyway. So to answer your questions, one, you do technically have to place via infiltrate unless you can fit in a vehicle. But yes, you can put a vehicle, you can put an infiltrate unit in a non-infiltrate, non-dedicated transport.
Right.
You just don't get any of the benefits from infiltrating. All right, so moving on. Number three, this one's more of a question for Kevin because it's Corn Demon. I think it's mostly Corn Demon Kin.
Right.
So this is from Andrew Littleton. Hey, guys, wanted to get your opinions on a couple of things. First off, my local gaming store that it was into a more narrative-style gameplay has closed its doors unexpectedly and left me without a local gaming group. So to get my 40K fix, I must now look at the more competitive scene, such as local tourneys. My questions or advice for you is how do you guys feel about Zufor the Impaler from IA Vrax? He was given a 10-point decrease in Imperial Armor 13 down to 165 points. He is equipped with a Strength 5 AP4 two-handed axe and a Power Fist that also has a built-in Assault 3 bolter. He has the Furious Charge, USR, Eternal Warrior, Mark of Khorne, Rage, and Counterattack, and a plus 2-up, 5-up, not the greatest, but not half bad. Is Zufor worth it in the competitive scene?
Okay, actually, I guess first off, just before we get into that question here, do we know where Andrew is actually from? Like, what area he lives in? Because since his store closed unexpectedly, maybe there's other people that will listen in that area that can hook up and play games with them. Because that sucks to lose your store unexpectedly.
Yeah. It does. I feel weird looking up information on the guy and putting it on the
air. I didn't know if he included it in the email.
No, he didn't. He did not. But Andrew, if you want to put that out there by posting on the Facebook page, feel free to try to find other players in your area that might be able to help you find more of the narrative feel that you're going for.
I wasn't sure if you put it in the email or not.
No, I did not.
Because I know sometimes people put it in the email, like, you know, Bob from Fort Wayne, Indiana, or whatever.
Yeah, so, not in this case.
Okay, as far as Zufor,
and also consider he can only be taken as a HQ choice for Chaos Space Marines.
Yeah, he can only be in Chaos Space Marines unless there is a specific rule that he gets that makes him super Hoss. Just the equipment that you listed out, it doesn't seem like it's worth 165 points, especially when if you're playing Chaos Marine Khorne, there is another 165 point Khorne HQ unit that would eat his lunch in Khorne. So take Khorne. A Strength 5 AP4 Power Axe is fucking awful. No way around it. That's awful. The AP3 Bolter is nice. 2-up, 5-up. All right, that's good. But the Eternal Warrior is nice. Like, that's getting Eternal Warrior for 165 points is nice, but unless he has some other like game or army changing special rule, I can't imagine he'd be worth it.
He's got Fearless, Eternal Warrior, Mark. I'm looking at is from the updated Imperial Armor of Vrax. Fearless, Eternal Warrior, Mark of Khorne, Furious Charge, Adamantium Will.
Yeah, I mean, he gets his advantage over Khorne at this point is Eternal Warrior. Armor, but...
Oh, and his Warlord trait is he gets a victory point for each enemy character slain in a challenge.
Yeah, with an AP4 Power Axe, you don't want to be in challenges, though. Like, that's... In general, there are very, very few named characters that are good for the competitive scene, just because you can't customize them and you can't really gain point sufficiency unless they also change, like, an army-wide rule.
And also, being a Forge World character, he may not be allowed in a lot of stuff.
I would say, like, just me personally, if I'm ever going to take him, I would rather just take Khorne. Because you're both limited to being Chaos Marines at that point. You can't take either of them in Khorne Demon Kin. Or just build a 165-point Khorne Lord out of the Chaos Marine book and give him the Axe of Blind Fury, and for about 165 points, you're going to be in better shape than this because it's an AP2 at initiative axe.
This is like an AP4 at initiative axe. It is too.
Yeah, but I mean, but
AP4.
Yeah, but AP4. That's not good.
Yeah,
yeah. So I would say probably not. I mean, if you have the model, if I remember correctly, it's cool. It's a really cool model.
Oh
so
yeah, Zufor's a wicked model.
Or the other thing to do maybe is use the model and just, you know, make up your own Khorne Terminator Lord that you could even put in Demonkin if you want to use that instead for a little extra flexibility. But
yeah. All right, so moving on to his next question. Next is, how much is too many points on an HQ? Currently, I'm building lists out of Khorne Codex Scorn Demonkin until a newer Codex Chaos Space Marine comes out, and I keep building HQ units that are around 240 points. Lord with the Juggernaut, Axe of Corn, Combat Familiar, Sigil of Corruption, and the Relic Armor. I have a slight feeling I sunk too many points into him. Any insight would be greatly appreciated. Before we get into Corn Demonkin specifics, I will say how many points you drop into an HQ is going to be dependent on what you think you're going to get out of that HQ. Right. Like 240 points and is less than I drop on my Buffmander because he pushes 300.
It's going to vary a lot between the different armies.
Right. I mean, your Buffmander, you spend 300 points. When I'm running my Tau list, I run more of a gunline army. I spend 50 points on an Ethereal, and that's it.
Yeah.
So it really just depends. You got to find points efficiency for what you're wanting to get out of it.
And, when we get into talking about Tyranids, you can get a Hive Tyrant up really expensive if you want.
Yeah.
But that Hive Tyrant may get a lot of work done for you, depending on what you want to do with it. So, I don't think there's necessarily how many points is too much. It's just, it is really within the Codex. Look at what else you can get. That one there looks a lot like the Corn Lord that I see you running in your Corn Demonkin.
I don't put the Relic Armor on mine, so I just have him running in Power Armor, but I give, Sigil of Corruption, I don't give him the Axe of Corn, I give him the axe that when he dies he summons in a Bloodthirster, the Relic Axe. Yeah. But, I mean, my guy runs about 240, 250 normally.
But gets work done.
But he gets work done. But the other thing, though, is if you're not taking Spawn or a unit of Corn Hounds, he's completely useless. In that army, because if he doesn't have anything to run with, then you're not really getting into the benefits of him being on a Juggernaut.
Yeah.
So again, it depends. Like that's a perfectly good get work done Lord, but if he's in a unit of Berserkers, it doesn't really matter that you're spending that many points on him. And then in that case you put him on foot and spend 60 points less.
Yeah.
So it really depends on what you're trying to get done with him. But for 240 points, that kit out, that'll get work done for you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't think that's too much. I don't, like we've kind of said, I don't think there is a too much point level really that you're going to prescribe to HQ in general.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Dennis has run an army that was nothing but HQs.
Right.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to keep the line moving here. So thanks for writing on that one, Andrew. Hopefully that gives you a little bit more insight into building your corn lists and coming up with the right HQ for you. Moving on, Chris Olson. So I've recently been looking into a Cerastus Knight, and I have some questions. The Forge World datasheet talks about it's taken as if any other knight out of the current Imperial Knight Codex other than it limits you to one because they're rare. The question is, are they allowed to take carapace weapons? I've been told by several knight players in the worldwide warp that the Cerastus can take heirlooms, but I don't know where it says yay or nay to those either. So looked up the Cerastus sheet, and the way it's worded is it says you can take it as in an Imperial Knight army as the way you would take any other Imperial Knight, or you can take it as a Lord of War choice for any army of the Imperium. So basically, you could take it in the place of any knight class as long as it doesn't specify a knight. Like, there's the formations that are like three knight crusaders or three knight gallons or whatever. But in a household detachment, you could definitely take a Cerastus. What that does not mean is that you get access to things that are specific data sheets. If you look at all the individual knight data sheets in the new Imperial Knight Codex, like the Crusader, the Errant, the Knight, the Paladin, etc., they all have a listing on there saying which carapace weapons they can take, which happens to be all three of them. The Cerastus does not have that. And so you can't take something from one data sheet and put it on the other,
right,
even though it says you can take a knight, take this as you would take any other knight. However, heirlooms are unlocked by the formations and detachments that you take them in, not by the listing on the data sheet. So you could absolutely put an heirloom on a Cerastus Knight by making it the Baron of your household detachment.
Which, honestly, if you're taking a Cerastus, you should make him the Baron because that's awesome.
Yeah.
And the other thing I've heard, too, is that one of the rumors for the Forge World FAQs and stuff is that at some point they are going to update all of those knights to make them compatible with the current Codex. So I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in the future you can take carapace weapons, but that would be an update specifically to that data.
And it also depends on if they're even modeled to be able to take those. Right. I don't know if they use the existing top carapace top or not. But for example, like the Exalted Court, It says all formations in this, all models in this formation have the vehicle, Super Heavy Walker character unit type, and they can each choose from the heirlooms in the knightly houses list. So, yeah, take a Cerastus in your Exalted Court or in your Baronial Court, and you can take heirlooms. And I think, don't they also have the formate, just like the general household detachment? Yeah, and the household detachment, you pick a Lord Baron, you pick a warlord, and it gains access to them. So, yeah, absolutely. Make Cerastus your warlord, and you can take the heirlooms because it's the detachment, not the datasheet, that unlocks that.
Right.
All right, moving on to the next question from Jordan Nikolaishin. Hey, guys, love the question segment you guys do on the show, and I particularly like that you take some time before the show to read through the questions and have an answer and page references ready.
The magic of editing.
Oh, exactly.
Prep work?
Acting. I have a question regarding shooting and weapon selection. When do you have to choose what weapon you are shooting? This might seem like a weird question, but it came up a couple of times in my last few games. I declared that I was going to shoot at a unit of warp spiders, and he, believing I was going to shoot plasma guns and bolters, decided to jump closer to me and grab an objective. It would have been a smart play, except I decided to shoot pistol and then charge him, ultimately killing the unit. This brought up the question, when do I have to declare what weapons I'm going to shoot before he makes the decision to jump? And Dennis, do you have your Eldar Codex at hand?
I'll grab it.
That's the one I didn't bring. This also came up against a Wave Serpent and Jink. When do I declare what weapons I'm firing? I wanted to shoot a Wave Serpent, and he had a multi-melta in the unit within 12 inches. He decided to jink, and I decided not to shoot the multi-melta, but to throw a grenade and try an assault instead. This turned out to be a better decision as I wrecked the vehicle and had it surrounded. However, if he didn't jink, I would have shot it with the multi-melta as it would have been had a better chance of killing it without the jink than the unit did an assault. So what do you guys think? Well, while Dennis gets his Eldar Codex so we can answer the specifics on the
warp spiders.
On the warp spiders, right. The shooting sequence is actually very clear on when you select which weapon to fire, and that is at step three of the shooting sequence, which the shooting sequence is, step one is you nominate the unit that's shooting, step two is you choose a target, step three is you select a weapon, and then you go through steps 4, 5, and 6 to resolve the shooting attack, and then if you have more than one weapon, you jump back to step three, which is when you select your next weapon. So at least on the Wave Serpent, Wave Serpent jink, any sort of jink happens when the unit is targeted, which is at step two. So you declare, I'm targeting that Wave Serpent. Eldar player says, I'll have him jink. Now you get to choose, well then fine, I will throw the grenade rather than fire the multi-melta because you have jinked. If he chooses not to jink, he can't change his mind once you start firing weapons.
Yeah.
And so if he chooses not to jink, then you choose the multi-melta and try to kill it.
Warp spiders are the same. That is when they are chosen as the target of attack.
Okay, so it basically works kind of like jink in that regard, that it is as soon as they are selected as a target, they may make the decision to jump. So, yeah, so in that case, in those two specific cases, Jink and Warp Spiders, you know, once they're targeted, it's there. So basically, it's step one, you pick your unit that's firing. Step two, you target their unit. Step, like, 2.5 is when their powers kick in after targeting, but before step three. And then step three is you choose what weapon you're going to fire. So that's when you could decide, I will fire pistols now at your Warp Spiders and then assault you in my assault phase. That's when you decide, oh, you jinked, well, I'm going to throw a grenade and then assault that warp or the Wave Serpent. Oh, you didn't jink, then I will select the multi-melta and try to blow you off the table. So, yeah, that is very important. I don't want to get into this until our time is over because there's something related to that I want to talk about regarding Tau coordinated firepower.
Right.
Which is actually what our next question is about. So thanks for writing in, Jordan. Hopefully that clarifies the shooting sequence for you. So the next question is from Darren Tse, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correct. It's T-S-E, Tse. Question, guy, for your next episode, how does Tau coordinated firepower and their ability to shoot and then run interact? How I read it is that if you wanted to run and shoot, you have to do it in that order, which is the hunter cadre says they have to run and then shoot. And you have to resolve both of them for a single unit before you can move on. Right. You can't mix and match them. How I read it is that if you want to run and shoot, you have to do it in that order. And if you want coordinated firepower, you all have to shoot at the same time. So the first unit could run, then shoot, but the others could not because they would have to shoot when the first unit is shooting. Or they would have to run, or they have to shoot when the first unit is shooting. You're absolutely correct. Because the way coordinated firepower works is you have that primary unit, They do their step one. Mm-hmm. At that point, before they can fire, they already have to have resolved their run.
Yeah.
And right. then when you're at the step where everybody starts piling their shots, nobody else has had a chance to run yet. They're just choosing to shoot. So they're basically giving up their option to run and then shoot in exchange for being able to pile in their firepower. So yes, one unit, the primary unit, could run. It would run, then it would shoot. Everybody would pile in on the shots, and then their shooting phase is done. You've resolved their shooting attacks. They don't get a chance to run. At least that is how I would rule it.
That makes sense.
All right, let's see how much time we have left. 15 minutes. I think we're actually making pretty good progress. Rules question. This is from Matt Hibble. Rules question. It's turn one. The Imperial Knight player has first turn. He moves, shoots, etc. It's now the Tyranid's turn. Zoanthropes move up and use Warp Lance against the Knight. Does the Knight get to use its Ion Shield? The rules state the Knight player is to declare what side the shield is on at the start of the opponent's shooting phase. Also, the Knight charges the Zoanthropes in assault. Can the Zoanthropes use our weapons are useless rule to leave the combat? Okay, number one, and Dennis and I were digging through this when we got this question, and basically said... What we found is, in the Imperial Knight Codex, Ion Shields are also positioned when the Knight is deployed. So the Knight's never without his Ion Shield. So so basically, as soon as the Knight's deployed, he chooses a facing for the shield. So the shield's up during that Tyranid player's psychic
phase.
Yeah, so he'll, unless you can get the Zoanthropes on outside of the facing the shield's covering, then he'll get the Ion Shield. So it'll be there. He won't get to reposition it until your shooting phase, though. Mm-hmm. That's why they can get around it, possibly.
And that would actually... And since he gets it when he deploys, that means that being able to position yourself in the psychic phase for psychic shooting attacks around a knight in the psychic phase pretty much applies regardless of whether it's first turn or not.
Right. Yeah, so but yeah.
So just, like, you could put Zoanthropes in a Tyrannocyte and then drop them behind a knight and zort them in the ass.
And he can't
really, and he can't change where his shield is until the shooting phase.
Exactly. Which is a great way to deal with a knight if you're a Tyranid player.
Right.
And question two, can the Zoanthropes use our weapons are useless? No, they can't, because Zoanthropes are Synapse.
Yes.
Synapse makes them fearless. Fearless means they can't fail a morale check, and our weapons are useless specifically says you choose to fail a morale check.
Yep.
They can't choose to fail it. It's the same reason why any Synapse, or any creature under the influence of Synapse, can't use our weapons are useless either.
Correct.
Which we'll talk about that when we get to the Tyranids.
Yeah.
All right. How much time we got left? 12 minutes. We're still doing good. All right, next one. Matthew Hurd. Rules question. In the Shadow Strike kill team formation, if you held both of your scout squads in reserves and they passed the reserve rolls, could you bring them in first and then deep strike the veterans near them with no scatter? There does not seem to be a rule indicating that scouts must be on the table from the start of the turn like there is with the locator beacon. That one is in Kalyan, and I brought the rules book with me this time. If I can find it in the stack of books.
Well, if you turn them so we could see the spines, we could see them better.
Got it.
Yeah. It's fun watching them struggle.
Yeah.
You guys are the best friends. So, really.
Yeah. You guys are my best friends.
All right. So, basically, it says that Vanguard Veteran Squads is the on-target rule. Vanguard Veteran Squads from this formation can charge on the turn they arrive from Deep Strike. In addition, they do not scatter when arriving from Deep Strike if the first model is placed within 9 inches of at least two scout squads from this formation. What that says to me, because the thing in reserves is you roll for everybody to come in, and then once you determine who is coming in, then you choose which ones to place. And you could, if both your scout units come in, and being that this is probably part of a Talon Strike Force, you could start rolling on turn one. So scout comes in, veterans, you choose whether they pass or fail the reserve roll, because that's the other part of the formation. So yes, you could absolutely place scout squad, and then veterans. And because it just says they have to be placed within 9 inches of two of the scout squads, it has nothing. Mm-hmm. You're right. It has nothing to do with whether they were on the table first turn or not. Just where they're deployed in relationship to one another. So I would say absolutely they can all come in on the same turn and keep the veterans from scattering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Makes sense.
Sounds right to me.
All right. 10 minutes left. And we get into a non-rules question. Trey Swanson. Hey, guys. Got a new question for you the new year. This one is not strictly a rules question, but asking for your opinion. Picture this situation. You're the TO at a tournament, and you are called for a ruling. The tournament has a strict no-proxying rule stating that if there's a question, to call the TO before the tournament day. However, one has slipped through the cracks all the way to the tournament's second round of three. What do you do? Let the player off with a warning? Stand by the rules as written? I'm curious, as if this has happened in past events, an example being a Marine player running a Gladius using the older Tiny Rhino from 2nd Edition with no other modifications as Razorbacks. So, as a TO, as somebody who is organizing tournaments, we don't have a strict no-proxying rule, but we do have a strict WYSIWYG rule at our events. And if somebody was on round two and they are found to be in violation of the rules for the event, as a TO, it's never an easy call to tell somebody they're playing the game. That, you know, not only are they playing the game wrong, but the army they've brought is wrong.
Right.
Unfortunately, the only way to be fair is to apply the rules evenly, and sometimes that means having to make non-fun decisions. In this case, the fact that they made it to the second round, I would basically, first off, you approach them and say, do you have any alternate models you can use to replace this? Because the example here is not just a matter of proxying, but it's a matter of these vehicles are not equipped.
Right.
I mean, yes, they're tiny, but I've seen, like, if a Sisters player brought 2nd Edition Rhinos and Immolators, but the Immolators, you know, they were 2nd Edition Immolators, but they were all equipped properly.
Right.
I would allow them, even though they are smaller than the standard vehicles now, because they are consistent. They're not proxies. But if you have a strict no-proxying rule, and that no-proxying rule has been made very clear to people ahead of time, it is on the TO to basically say, okay, look, Do you have models that actually fit this? Well, if the answer is yes, then you better swap them out right now. And right. If not, then you're either going to have to run without them, which means you may have to run a few hundred points down, or you're going to have to take a loss every round because you're technically breaking the rules of the game as we've established them for this tournament.
Right.
They don't get to use their free dedicated transport.
The Gladius, is low-hanging fruit on that one. But,
right. Yeah, I know. But, I almost didn't say it, but, you know. Yeah.
But, no.
I was going to if you didn't.
Right.
But, you know, that's just the issues that you get into with something like that. It's it'd be like if you had a strict everything must be painted and based, and somebody came in and had like a model that wasn't, and their opponent called them on it, then you'd have to go, okay, well you have to pull that model. I'm sorry. I mean, if we've got a strict rule on it, or the other thing you could do if the person, it depends on, like, you know, you can basically say, okay. You can go. The other thing you could say is you can go ahead and keep playing, but you're going to take a loss on every game you play because you're playing with an illegal army. So your opponent's going to get an automatic win against you in every game.
Yeah.
But
at least they get to finish out their tournament.
Yeah.
Their game.
Yeah. So if it's a matter of I don't have the models, it's like, well, I got a strict rule. You know, if the tournament has a strict rule against it, it's either I can let you play, but you're going to lose. You're going to auto lose every game, but you can at least still get to play. Now, if it's really somebody who's really competitive, they should have known better. They should have checked the tournament rules. And really, the concern is that their player first turn didn't call them on it.
Right.
And some people would say, well, it's up to the judge to make sure all these armies are legal. Even at our small local Rotrader style tournaments, it's sometimes hard to keep track of, you know, to go around and personally inspect everybody's army and make sure everything's legit.
Yeah.
So, and if this was a larger event, even if you've got three or four judges, like, I haven't been to a GT where they've inspected my army and my army list to make sure everything matches up and that everything's the appropriate size and everything. But if my opponent calls me on it, they can definitely go get the TO or judge and have the issue addressed, and that at that point the judge has to make a tough call. It sucks.
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of it. Like, if you're at a tournament or especially a competitive event, something like that, where those rules are in place,
you as the player need to be able to, you know, need to be confident enough in the TO to bring that to them, you know, and be looking, not necessarily like looking for like ways you can game the system, but if you see stuff that violates the rules, it's also your responsibility to help point it out too.
Right. I mean, if your opponent, you know, does something that's of violation of the rules mm-hmm. that have been established and you call them on it, it's like, for example, if, you know, that first turn, you should, you know, the guy who's playing against the proxied Razorback should say, like, wait a minute, those aren't Razorbacks, right. And there's a no proxy rule here. Why are those Razorbacks? Oh, well, I just don't have the models for them. Well, you should have known
still
that.
You still need to get the TO involved at that point, because at least if they make the decision in round one that, okay, he can use these, but he has to use them as rhinos because they're not kitted as Razorbacks. Okay, then at least that the ground rules have been established for the rest of the tournament, and you're not changing it, you know, not having to change it in round two or round three later when somebody else notices.
Yeah, round two is when it gets iffy, because how round one turned out. Like, if that guy got a overwhelming win, like, you know, all battle points, or, you know, however you're scoring it, and, you know, they got the win, they got all the victory points, etc. Now you have to look at, do you invalidate their first win?
Right.
You know, like, at that point, it's like, I don't think I would necessarily invalidate their first win, because that's going to screw up your scoring for everything else. But at that point, you just basically say you will take a zero in battle points and you will automatically lose. I mean, however the game plays out, you lose.
Yeah.
So you're just playing this out. At that point, you're playing this out for fun. But I think you always give the player a chance to make it right, whether it's by taking the units off the field or having alternate mm-hmm. models if they have available. Or, like you said, okay, well, especially if a Gladius, they're free, they didn't cost you anything. Okay, you play them as rhinos.
Right.
You have to play them as they're equipped. So if you don't have Razorbacks, well, you're going to have to take them as rhinos.
Yeah.
And then if you do that one, then I think it behooves you, it makes your job as a TO a little bit harder, but you have to go every round, go back to that table and check on it and make sure that he's playing them as rhinos or make sure he's not using them.
Yeah.
And because you basically have to tell that player, look, I'm going to check on you every round and make sure that you're doing this, you're doing it clean. Or because at that point,
I mean, because the worst thing that could happen as a TO, especially if you're running, say, like a big event, something like that, is to let that slide and not address it, even though that's clearly in the rules, and then find out, you know, at the end of day one or day two, that people are like, well, you know, TO let that person, you know, I'm not going to come back next year because they let that person violate the rules because so-and-so's friend. Like, it to be a TO, you have to make those hard calls, and you have to be consistent and enforce those rules that are put in place. Because if you don't, then it just creates all sorts of other problems down the line that may be tough to overcome.
It's like if you find out somebody was running an army that was like 5 or 10 points over them. Like, it's an 1850 event. If somebody runs a list that turns out to be 1860 and nobody catches it until like day two of a big GT, you're going to have people pissed because all of a sudden somebody wasn't playing by the rules. And that one falls on the judges. It falls, you know, it also falls on the other players for not catching it. But when you go into a big event, you kind of hope that the judge has already kind of
mm-hmm.
gone over things and made sure everything's kosher. So, you know, it can throw a pall on the entire event by just allowing one player to kind of get around the rules, because it's either you end up with favoritism or, you know, or accusations of favoritism, whether you know the guy or not.
Right.
Or it can end up with, you know, accusations of, well, the judge isn't taking this seriously. He's just letting people do whatever they want.
Yeah, neither one of those are good. That's not what you want to develop a reputation for.
Right. So part of that means, you know, sometimes being a TO or, you know, a judge means you have to be a bit of a hard ass and give the player a chance to make it right, though. Always give that. But yeah, in this situation, I would say either tell the player to either run without him, run him as rhinos, or take losses.
Yep.
From that point on. Because if they take one loss, they're probably at zero battle points, they're pretty much out of the running competitively anyway. So at that point, you know, the job's done, and then you just either track that player and give them zeros for the rest of the day, or you just check on them and make sure they're doing things the right way. That one probably ate a lot of time. Let's see. 30 seconds left. Well, I'm sorry. We have another stack from a listener. I'm just going to say his name, Jonathan Louis from Canberra, Australia. Jonathan, we'll get to your questions next episode. We just had a huge backlog, but I think with all of Jonathan's questions, that'll be enough for the next episode.
Yeah.
So I apologize, Jonathan, for not getting to your questions, but we only had so much time before it's going to be too late in the night to... We could have done a whole episode of just your listener questions. And I know we got even more questions since I compiled the list of questions for this episode. So, Jonathan, we will get to your questions next episode, episode 119. And so we're going to take a quick break. We're going to have a word from our sponsor, KR Multicase. And unfortunately, I was not able to get the guys from the Flying Monkey GT out of Wichita for this episode. I'm hoping to get them on in episode 119. So next time, next episode, you'll be hearing an interview with them, I hope. But tonight, you'll just be hearing our word from our sponsor, and then we will be getting into So You Want to Start an Army,
Tyranids. Miniatures. We build them. We paint them. We love them.
That's why we also want to get them to the battle and back again safely.
And that's where KR Multicase comes in. They offer a complete model storage and transport system.
They offer a wide selection of core trays for standard size miniatures, as well as custom cut trays for specific models.
KR's trays are made of a soft foam, available in a variety of colors that won't scratch or snag your models.
And to protect the foam, the trays are carried in easily stackable, swappable cardboard cases.
They also offer a full range of Kaiser bags, backpacks, and aluminum cases for transporting your KR cases.
You can even choose from pre-built tray selections to suit your army, or use the autofill app to find just the right trays for your particular force.
Whatever your game, 40K, X-Wing, Warm Hordes, or Historicals, KR Multicase has the cases to fit your needs.
You can find out more at krmulticase.com.
KR Multicase, soft foam for your figures, hard cases for the soft foam. And we're back. And with that, we're going to continue our series on So You Want to Start an Army with the Tyranids, another army that's been featured in the Start Collecting boxes.
Yep.
So as our format has been for our one time of doing this, we're going to talk about the fluff reasons why you might want to play this army, the rules reasons why you might want to play this army, whether the Start Collecting box is a good deal and what you get out of it, and then where you might want to go from there and how to build your collection. So, Richard, you are a resident Tyranid player. Why would you want to, like, fluff-wise, want to start playing Tyranids? What is it about Tyranids that grabs you?
It's just that overwhelming sense of, you know, swarms and swarms of just unearthly controlled little bodies scurrying towards you and not being able to, you know, scare them away, or no matter how many you kill, they just keep coming. Sort of enemy that it's really frightening, and the chance to actually be that hive mind that controls all those little bodies is actually kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same reason why, like, the bugs from Starship Troopers or the Zerg or even the Borg in Star Trek are interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's this unyielding wall of things that you can't really reason with, can't really defeat. You can just hope to push him off to the side a little bit for a while.
Right.
See, and I thought the whole reason would be you got to be the one to get rid of another race.
Well, there's that too. Yeah. So a little bit of background on the Tyranids. The Tyranids are basically a mega organism, kind of a gestalt organism made out and hive mind made out of billions and billions of individual creatures from outside the Milky Way, pushing its way in various arms and hive fleets, pushing its way into the Milky Way from intergalactic space. And they basically, they're not quite insectile. They're not quite reptilian.
They're not quite crustacean.
Yeah. They're a little bit of
everything.
They're monsters.
They are very much monsters. And they are implacable. As Kevin said, you cannot reason with them. You cannot negotiate. And they exist only to devour all the biomatter on a planet, incorporate it into their own hive fleet, and then leave planets as dry, desiccated husks and just move on from planet to planet like locusts.
Yep. Yeah.
And theoretically, we haven't even seen the core of the Tyranid Hive fleet.
Yeah, everything so far that we've seen is apparently just kind of the scout tendrils of just unimaginably like massive amounts of aliens. We have no idea how many there are.
It's like if you could make aliens out of the heat death of the universe, it would be the Tyranids. Because really, it's like it would take all the other races in the Games Workshop universe combining their efforts and, you know, stopping killing each other for once and combining their efforts and fighting off against the Nids, and even that might not be enough.
Well, as our friend Tim would always just say, he's like, you know how the Games Workshop universe ends. Tyranids come through and devour everything. And then leave, and the Necrons just take it back over what's there because Tyranids aren't really going to eat them because they're just metal.
And in fact, in the fluff, Tyranids hive fleets have actually been known to avoid Necron tomb worlds,
right?
Because there's a lot of those are just dead, dry worlds right. Anyway. There's nothing for them to consume.
Necrons are the ultimate winners.
Yeah. Well, and actually, they have also been known to avoid entanglements with chaos as well.
Because there's no biomass.
Because there's actually no real biomass there.
True.
The only time they really fight them or the Necrons is when they perceive them as a threat, as just another predator on their prey.
Yeah. So yeah, like if chaos is attacking an Imperium planet and then Tyranids show up, Tyranids will fight both because A, they want to devour the Imperium biomass, and B, the chaos units are possibly killing their biomass to eat.
Yes.
Right.
And it's a fleet that also tends to absorb species and by devouring them kind of incorporate their strengths into their own. And they are also very adaptive. That is another classic Tyranid trope, is that I remember reading fluff. I can't remember if it was in an older Tyranid codex or if it was in a Tau codex. Maybe in one of the older Tyranid codexes, where the Tau were fighting against a Tyranid incursion, and like they'd slaughter waves and waves of Hormigons and Termigons and things like that, and then the next batch would show up and they would have armor that was proof against the Tau weapons, or they'd be faster in getting to them and assaulting. They were evolving to counter the weapons.
Yeah.
Now that you don't see modeled on the table too much, just because it's very hard to. I mean, basically, what's on the tabletop would be that first wave where they haven't adapted yet.
Yeah.
Or if you build them out a certain way, it's the wave that has adapted, but that getting the kind of rotating through that cycle doesn't really work.
Yeah.
But that said, what's neat about that is that we mentioned the Tau, kind of a race that has managed to evolve through the fluff in the 40K universe. Tyranids are another army that when they do an update and they update the book or they release new models, it's a way for them to be like, okay, this is the next wave, this is the next upgrade. And it's much better than, there's much more of a fluff reason to like introduce new things as opposed to like, hey, the Space Marines found Snuggy armor hidden away in their in their vaults that they didn't realize anybody had.
But they've been using it the whole time. Wink.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Whereas the Nids come up with a new creature, let's say, well, it's a bioform we haven't seen before.
Right.
They must have evolved it to use it on another planet where it was more applicable.
Right, or we just hadn't seen it yet because it hadn't showed up yet.
Because there's so many
species
of Nids. And that's the other thing about Nids is if you, like, Space Marines, you have infantry and boxy tanks and maybe a flyer or two, and that's about it. Everything's kind of roughly the same scale. Whereas Nids, you've got everything going from the smallest ripper in a ripper swarm all the way up to, like, you get into Forge World and you've got bio titans and things like that. But in the middle ground, in the standard 40K stuff, you've got, like, your waves and waves of little Hormigons and Termigons, but then you've got monstrous creatures like Carnifexes and Tyrannifexes and Tyrannocytes, and you've got, you can make an entire army or close to it of big things.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And or you want to do flying creatures? Well, there's entire formations that are built around flying hive tyrants and hive crones and harpies and gargoyles and things like that. I mean, there's variety in how you, if you want to do just that endless swarm army, you can do that. If you want to do what's called Nidzilla, where it's all big creatures, you can do that. If you want to do something in between, you want to do all flying. The one thing they don't have in plastic yet are any gargantuan creatures.
Right.
I would imagine that if they get an update sometime, that will be something they address.
I imagine so.
They do have a couple. I mean, they've got the Biotitan, but they also have like the Higher Duels and the Herodin that you can get from Forge World.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Herodin has rules in Escalation, if I remember right.
I believe so. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are options that, you know, for running some of those bigger things. So now we're kind of starting to shift into the rules reasons for why you might want to play Nids or what really encapsulates Nids as an army rule-wise. So, again, Richard, I will turn the table to you.
Yeah. I mean, you really do have an army construction where you're going to have some very linchpin pieces to your army, and they provide synapse. And what synapse does is it makes any of the units that are within that synapse range fearless, which is a very good benefit.
Yeah.
So you don't have, no matter how many like guys you lose to shooting or guys you lose in close combat, you're just going to keep going, going to keep attacking. It's not a concern.
Yeah, and the fluff reasoning behind synapse is, as we said, the Tyranids are a hive-minded race made up of billions and billions and billions upon billions of individual creatures. Well, those individual creatures do have instinctive minds and behaviors of their own.
Right.
But if you've got those linchpin units that kind of broadcast the hive mind's will, they can override that instinct and direct them into attacks.
Right.
Even if they're sacrificial, suicidal attacks, they can push them in that direction.
Yes.
Let's see. So linchpin units that are kind of the key to the army. They have a form of psychic defense, but it doesn't.
It was written for use in a previous edition, really, is what it boils down to.
And even though, the most recent book is still
a sixth edition book.
Yeah. This is one of the last sixth edition books as far as codexes. And so if you look through this book, it is not arranged in the same format as your newer codexes. Mm-hmm. Where it's like a data sheet with a picture of the model.
Right.
It is an older style codex for a previous age, and it does show. I will say this is competitively a harder army to play.
Yes, yeah. It is.
It
because when those linchpin models go down,
and that's exactly it. If you know. Every single Tyranid army has to have certain things in it, and if you've played Tyranids or know how they work, you target that first, then the whole thing kind of crumbles. So
yeah,
it is a difficult army to play.
Yeah,
competitively.
Also, if you are playing Tyranids, you're going to have to track down a couple of books.
Yeah.
To really get the whole army, because you'll have to have your codex,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the Leviathan Rising set of books, which is a digital download only.
Yes.
And then there's Shield of Baal Leviathan, which I think at this point is also digital only. I don't know if you can still get the soft...
I don't know that the soft cover is available anymore.
I can actually check that real quick.
It looks like it is digital only, or at least on the GW website, it appears to be digital only.
Yep, Shield of Baal Leviathan Interactive Edition. There might be a non-interactive edition on the
Black Library
page. Yeah,
probably.
But yeah, unless you can find a version of it, you know, at your friendly local game store, most likely you're going to have to get a digital edition.
Yeah, which, you know, okay, you can get the Shield of Baal Leviathan ebook for $45. You can get the Leviathan Rising Collection for $32.99. The Leviathan one, or the Shield of Baal Leviathan, you definitely want to get because that has the stats for the new units. Although, I think those are actually still available.
I think they are still for free. I think you can still download those.
It's hard to find the link for it because it's kind of buried a little bit on their site. Here we go. Black Library and Warhammer Digital, free to download rules. I'll have to post a link to these in the show notes because, like I said, I don't think there's a link directly to this page anywhere.
Yeah.
But it is there, and they have the rules for the Maliceptor, the Mucolid Spore Cluster, the Sporacist, the Toxicrine, the Tyrannocyte, and the Zoanthrope Brood, which is technically a unit that's in the Codex, but it's been updated slightly.
Right. Yes.
So, yeah, you can get away with just your Codex and these, but then you don't get the formations. And formations really are the way they've been kind of patching this Codex and making it work better.
Yeah.
Also, Leviathan gives you access to a better Warlord trait table.
Yes.
And a better better core detachment.
Right. Because the core detachment actually lets you re-roll instinctive behavior rolls, is something that once the starts going bad,
right? Yeah.
It can kind of help that not be as bad.
Yeah.
Because when tiered creatures that are not synapse fall outside of synapse range, they default to their instinctive behavior. And that can be anything from I run at the enemy and try to slash their face off, and maybe my own, or the guy next to me. Or I just run away because there's not a place to hide.
Right. I try to hide and cover, and if I can't find cover, I just keep running.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just felt like running.
Yeah.
Stop.
Also, this does tend to be a psyker heavy army, but you're very limited on what psychic powers you, because you only have access to the one psychic discipline in the Codex.
Right. Which means, you know, it's really easy. You don't have to ever decide, oh, am I going to swap out for the Primaris power? No.
Because I'll always
have it, because I'll have the psychic mastery focus thing.
True. Which, to be fair, their Primaris power is very good for this army because it increases your synapse range, so your linchpin units get better.
Right. I mean, there's actually not a ton of psychers in the army. It's just the ones that are there are generally the ones that get run a lot.
Well, and your main HQ, the Hive Tyrant, is psychic by default.
Yes.
And some of the other core units that you often see, like
like Zoanthropes are pretty common.
Right. Zoanthropes.
The Turvagon.
Yes. Yeah. Which is an HQ, but can also be a troop.
Right. If you, it's one of those few things left that is a slot swapper.
Right. Because it's a 6th edition holdover.
Yes.
When Tyranids get a 7th edition redo,
I imagine that will go away, but you'll get like a formation that'll
cover it.
Yeah. So, but the Turvagon's neat because it's that thing that can provide you the closest thing on the tabletop to that endless wave kind of thing, because it actually spawns little extra units of little Griblies to keep going on the table.
Yeah. So, yeah, there are very few units these days that can spawn more things.
Yeah.
Biovores can also spawn more things.
Yes.
Yeah, because you have one of the few armies that can just make living artillery that just falls down on the table, and if it doesn't explode immediately, it will just kind of drift around and run into things.
Yep.
And in fact, when we did our 4-player New Year's kind of rotating game, you brought a formation that could just keep respawning them over and over again.
Yep. And they pretty much all kept coming back.
Yep. I think there was one that didn't make it at one turn, but
I probably failed that roll because that's how that night went.
Yeah. Yeah, most likely it was you.
Yeah. I'll take that.
So basically, I mean, the core to the Tyranid army is that you do have that to work around that synapse, and it is important to follow. You also, your guns aren't quite like everyone else's. I mean, the basic flesh borer gun that your Termagants carry is kind of like a really short range bolter, but
it's actually the equivalent of a bolt pistol.
Yeah.
is what it is.
With like an extra shot, isn't it? Or is it assault one?
The standard flesh bore is assault one.
Okay, so basically everybody's carrying pistols or slightly better. Not a lot of low AP in the army.
No. There's only like a few things that are better than AP4.
Where you're going to be getting your AP2 is from having big creatures go and beat up on vehicles or on Terminators, things like that, because Smash will be your friend.
Yes. Yes. Or, you know, a Carnifex. Carnifex doesn't really need to Smash.
But, that is right. True. What? But I mean, the Smash rule giving them AP2.
Right. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, Carnifexes are your living battering rams that can pretty much just kill anything they touch.
Yeah. They just have to get there.
They have to get there. And that's another problem that this army can have is that it is an army that is almost entirely – well, it's entirely without vehicles.
Yeah. Yes.
And so until they added the Tyrannocyte back in, the 6th edition Codex did not have a way to deep strike anything in.
Aside from any of the jump stuff.
Right.
But yeah, the Tyrannocyte's pretty neat. It's basically your living drop pod.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned when you're talking about the evolutions and stuff in there. It seems like a lot of the units in this army are very Eldar-ish, kind of in the like that they are like do one specific thing.
Yeah,
like you have a unit that comes in and they do this one thing. Like the Carnifex, you know, is a living battery ram, but doesn't really do much in, you know, isn't a psyker, doesn't do much in the shooting phase.
Well, unless you make it into unless a dock effects, but right. You have to equip it. Specifically,
but you can kind of do it one way or the other, and it's like it's either good for this role or this role. You don't really have a lot of just general use stuff, so you do have to build very specific units to do a certain task.
And I think that's why you want access to those books that give you the various formations, because when you're stuck to the standard combined arms detachment, you really start hitting the limitation of I only have 3 elite slots, and all my elites are
the good things.
Well, they're good things. They're all very focused to do one thing well. Like my Zoanthropes are my elite, and they are psychic support and my anti-vehicle shooting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Or I have my what else was in the elite slot?
The Hive Guard.
Hive Guard,
which are also very good at anti-vehicle.
Right.
And now have the they have like a haywire option now.
Right. And they can ignore line of sight also, which is really helpful for them. That's also where your Venomthropes are, which can give you cover, which for this army that also has very poor armor saves is very important.
Yes. It and not only does it have very poor armor saves, the book is almost entirely devoid of invulnerable saves.
Yeah, what, one?
Hmm?
Just one?
There is, including the everything that they've added since the Codex came out, there is 2.5.
Woohoo!
Because the Swarm Lord has an invulnerable save, but it only works against close combat wounds.
Ah, right. There you go. Okay, that would make sense.
And then you have the Endocrine, which is like the monstrous creature version of like the Zoanthrope.
Right.
And then you have the Zoanthrope, which both have like psychic fields that they use that give them an invulnerable save.
Right. So basically everything else is relying on toughness and multiple wounds to get to survive.
Or sheer numbers.
Which is an interesting – that's interesting because it does a different thing than other armies.
Yeah.
Like it does it. It's not as effective.
it's not as effective because, well, let's face it, the design philosophy of, ooh, I have lots of wounds and high toughness and lots of models, lots of little bodies, no armor saves, no invulnerable saves really to speak of, is something that they've had since like the 4th edition Codex. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of carried through even to this current day, but the environment of 40K really has changed. And so like big monstrous creatures that like the only thing that they really needed to fear was like, oh, like this guy has a force weapon that can just kill me in one hit. Well, now there's lots more stuff that has like instant death and D is a thing that is in the game.
Fleshbane, poison. Or
technically just wait a fire because most of them have three ups. You don't have a ton of two ups.
There's one.
Yeah.
And so you're going to be failing saves.
And that's the thing. You know, things that will kill, designed to kill Terminators, will take out a Carnifex. You know?
Yeah.
So
things that are designed to kill power armor guys will kill Carnifexes.
Yeah. That's where the army needs some sort of, I think, readjustment, just because that design philosophy can work. It's just, you're right, like it's not congruent with the rest of the armies that exist in this universe.
Which is the irony that you have the army that is supposed to be the most adaptive and most quickly evolving, right, and it has not. In fact, it's probably been the least evolving.
We're still on the first wave, right?
Right.
Well, yeah.
But like the Shadows and the Warp rule, like we said, was really good once upon a time.
When psychic powers worked off of leadership.
Right.
Right.
Now
they don't anymore.
Now they don't, and it really doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
It makes the chance of getting a bad perils result better.
Right.
But that's it. I mean,
like, if the army had more things that were like, ooh, we're scary, take a leadership tech, and use, like, the lowest available leadership value.
Which is something they used to do.
Yes.
Right.
Or, you know, an army that was basically a walking bubble of Kalexis Assassin would also be very scary.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh.
Yeah, but I mean, really, how the Shadow of the Warp ability is in the fluff. It's the idea is that the Hive Mind puts out this field of effectively psychic static.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so astropath messages don't get out. Navigators stop working. Premier psychers can't channel powers anymore. And the Hive Mind itself, Tyranids, they technically aren't psychic. It's just using the psychic system is the best way to model it for them. Now, there are modern ways that could be handled. Like, if they could basically deny all powers, like, on two up or three up on the dice, things like that, or...
But that still would only be if they were targeted, so all the blessings and stuff would still go off.
You could always make a rule that says that, you know, if there's a Tyranid, if there's a synapse creature within like 24 inches,
that they can deny
the controlling player can deny all powers on like a four or there would be ways to adapt it. But
if you specify that it worked on blessings and summons.
Yeah, but
and stuff
we're
like that.
Getting into wish listing where to go with this army. So let's start with the start collecting box, which is a Hive Tyrant, and that's a Hive Tyrant with all the fixins, so you can have it with wings, all the weapon options that they have in that box, etc. It's
a really good kit.
Oh, it's a fantastic kit. And it's one that was redone in the last couple of years, because I think they redid it when the new Tyranid codex came out, which was one of the last codexes of 6th edition. So it's only a couple of years old.
Yeah.
So you've got that. You've got a box of 3 Tyranid Warriors, which was another kit that was redone that long ago, or around the same time.
Yeah, it was pretty much that same time.
Yeah. And then a box of, or the equivalent of a box of 10 Gargoyles.
Yes.
Which is not actually an older kit, but the Gargoyles, I think, still hold up decently well.
The plastic on them was updated from the metals, and they look pretty good. I mean, they still hold up really well versus, you know, even the newer models.
And one thing we will say about storing these models is it's a very pokey army.
Yes.
Lots of delicate spindly bits. So you want to get a good storage solution.
Mm-hmm.
We personally recommend Carrick Multicase. In fact, you have your Tyranids in a KR case now.
Yep.
And as you know, I think you mentioned you had some issues with some of the stuff you had converted, but that is going to be an issue with anybody that converts things.
Right.
So the formation that it comes with is called the Hive Vanguard, and the requirements are a Hive Tyrant, which equipped any way you want, a Tyranid Warrior unit, and a Gargoyle unit. No restrictions, and the rules are swoop forth. If at the start of this formation's movement phase, the Hive Vanguard's unit of Gargoyles is within 18 inches of its Hive Tyrant, it can swoop forth instead of moving, remove the unit from the battlefield, even if locked in combat. It then immediately arrives anywhere on the board using the rules for Deep Strike. It will not scatter if it attempts to Deep Strike within 6 inches of the Tyranid Warriors from this formation.
Which is kind of an interesting thing. I mean, it gives you some control with a unit that isn't really necessarily meant to be like a close combat unit. I mean, they're jump, so you know they can get the advantage of Hammer of Wrath attacks. They can take some upgrades that give them poison and furious charge.
Don't they have blind attacks as well? They can take that.
It's called blinding venom, and it doesn't actually cause blinding.
Oh, right.
At least I don't think it does. It's essentially just they trade in all of their close combat attacks, which they only have one anyway, unless they're actually charging. And then they get like 6+ poison on their attack.
Nope, their attacks do have blind. They're 6 up poison blind. But each... But basically, the model has to trade all its attacks
right.
for one attack that is strength 3, 6 up poison blind.
Right. And the unit itself is strength 3. So, like, it's good for if they're still stuck in combat with something.
Yeah. I mean, the get out of jail free in combat is kind of nice.
Right. Which really, I mean, I guess you think about it. Trying to think of how that interaction works. If they have 6+ poison, but their roll to wound would need to be a 5 anyway, are they getting rerolls?
Let's see, because the poison, I think it's tied to the actual strength. Let's see. Poison. And this army can get a lot of melee poison because
yes.
they can take pretty much anything can take toxin sacks.
Yeah.
So poisoned, let's see. If the strength of the wielder is higher than the toughness of the victim,
okay.
the wielder yes. must reroll failed to wound rolls.
Okay. So it's not...
So the
6+ poison really... 6+ poison on a 3 strength unit, it doesn't really do much against most things unless you're going against something that's really, really tough.
Right.
Because most of the times they're going to be only wounding on 6s. Anyway,
right. Well, think of it kind of like Necron Gauss against
yeah.
living targets.
Right. I mean, it'll be useful against gargantuan creatures because they That's only the get wounded. Poison. They only get wounded on 6s against poison anyway. So,
yep. So
it also means they could actually hurt the Wraith Knights.
Yeah.
So actually, reading the poisoned rule in here, it says. Always wounds on a fixed number, generally shown in brackets, unless a lower result would be required when attacking. So if you would hit them on a 5, you would still be able to hit them on a 5, even with poison 6.
Yeah.
Right.
You just wouldn't get the rerolls unless you're fighting something with toughness
2. Right.
So.
Which is like Gretchen.
Right.
Yeah.
That's it.
Or Eldar that have been hurt by the Skitarii
right.
thingy.
There's other ways
well,
to get it,
yeah.
yeah.
That's true. But anyway.
Then you'd have to be Skitarii plus Tyranids.
Seen it.
Now, outside of the outside of the formation that they have here, though, I mean, besides, you know, you obviously get the new warrior box, you get the new Hive Tyrant box, and the gargoyles. There's other formations that use gargoyles that are
yes,
definitely
that,
better.
That than are actually that are way better than this.
yeah,
because there's the Skyblight Swarm.
Yeah,
yes.
Which is my personal favorite, and I like to run whenever I can.
Well, I mean, so just talking real quick about how good of a deal this box is, it's $85. The Hive Tyrant is $53 by itself,
yeah.
and the Warriors are $51 by themselves.
Yes.
So just right there.
That's $106.
Yeah. Right even before you get to the Gargoyles, you've already saved $20.
Yeah.
So, and then Gargoyles, let me find them on here. They're $30 for a unit of 10. So you're basically saving $50 retail.
Yeah.
On this box, which is, so you basically get into the Warriors for free or the Hive Tyrant for free.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah,
pretty fantastic.
and we're talking about some of the other formations. Like, for one, there's the Sky Tyrant Swarm, which is one
yes.
you use during the New Year's game.
Yes.
That one is a Hive Tyrant and 2 Gargoyle Broods. Well, guess what? 2 of these boxes will get you 2 Gargoyle Broods.
Yep.
And it would get you then an additional HQ and 2 troops with the 2 units of Warriors.
Yep.
Yeah.
So you could build a CAD and a formation out of 2 of these boxes.
Right. Or you could, you could actually theoretically make a Tyranid Prime out of the because the parts for a Tyranid Prime are now
in the
Warrior box.
However, I think you can still only take units, or you have to take warriors and minimum
warriors
units of three.
Are minimum three. So
you have
to get those two troop units, you'd still need to do all just warriors,
right,
and not the prime.
Right. And then, so this is kind of like the Tau box. This is not a, in fact, I'd say even more so than the Tau box, this is a good one to double up on.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because the Tau one, you end up with two Ethereals, which you can use, but it's a bit of overkill.
Right.
Whereas two Hive Tyrants is never a bad thing.
Hive Tyrants are probably hands down my favorite unit in the book. They're just really beefy, and they can be, they're actually very flexible.
Mm-hmm.
They can do, you can set them up to where they do a little bit of shooting and can do close combat. You can kit them out to where they're just nothing but close combat. You can kit them out to where they just shoot.
Yeah, like the classics Flying Tyrant or Flyrant, you might hear the term.
Right.
The Hive Tyrant with wings and with two pairs of twin-linked devourers with brain leech worms.
Yes, very popular.
Very popular choice. Very nasty, difficult to deal with. Also, you can make that Hive Tyrant into the Swarm Lord.
Yes.
Yeah.
And have a named character out of that box.
Yes, and he is quite powerful. He's fairly expensive, but he actually provides a lot for the army. He's one of the few like name characters still in the game that really do like a lot of like the force multiplier kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Because he can like hand out a USR per turn.
He affects your reserve rolls.
He affects your reserve rolls. He has a larger than normal synapse range.
And he's a stronger than the normal psyker.
Yes. He has a higher than normal synapse range if you make him your warlord.
Right.
Which if you take him,
you're gonna make him
your warlord. And he is, and he can very much like blend in close combat.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Well, and that's the interesting thing that you mentioned comparing this to like the Tau one. Ethereals, there's several different ways to kit him out, but you know, it doesn't really matter. With this, with the Hive Tyrant, the variations of being able to fly or being able to put him as a Swarm Lord, having two, three models to make each of those different ones, because it's not really a model that you can really easily kit bash to like take the wings on and off. Like it doesn't really, the way it's designed, it doesn't really work that way. So if you put the wings on it, you're kind of, that's the options you have.
Right. Yeah. Although his other arm options are actually fairly easy to magnetize. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I know you had some problems getting the wings to work, you know.
But yeah, if you're going to go flying, dedicate yourself to a flyer.
Yeah,
don't try to go, but you know, to make it a on foot and flyer. But yeah, then once you have one picked, then the arms themselves can be swapped out for whichever you'd want to do. Now, okay, so let's say you've picked up one of these boxes or maybe two of them. Both are good. You know, both choices are good.
Mm-hmm.
Some other places you can go, and this is one we've mentioned before in relation to this, the Tyranid Swarm, which is $170, which, so like if you take one Start Collecting box and this, you're at $255, and you'll need another like $50 for your codex. Mm-hmm. So $300 total, but for the Tyranid Swarm is $170. Seems to be ongoing accessibility. It's not a limited time bundle or anything. It's been out for like at least a year at this point.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
If not more. And it is, and they talk about how it's fantastic value. It absolutely is for what you're getting, because it's 10 gargoyles, 40 hormigaunts, which are the close combat little griblies.
Yes.
40 termigaunts, which are
the little shooty
griblies. A carnifex, which again, you can equip out to be close combat. You can make shooting. You can make a special character out of it by giving it the old one-eyed pieces.
Yep.
And then four Ripper Swarms, which is just a little swarm throw-in unit you can use.
Yeah.
But I mean, considering you can't run a unit up to 40, can you? I think they cap out at like 30.
30s, yeah.
So you're talking probably four units of troops out of that,
The Rippers are troops also.
So four, so five units of troops out of there. A fast attack, which you could just add on to your existing gargoyles and make a swarm of 20.
Right.
And then a Carnifex, which, as we said, in close combat, or in, I mean, you can equip it for shooting. In close combat, it's a beast.
Yeah. Like, even if you equip it as like a shooting one, it's still not really a slouch in close combat.
No, not by any means. And so, I mean, that would be, that is a really fast way to build up your army. Also, if you'll notice those model counts, Nids are an army that will have a lot of models.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if you are not a fan of army, I mean, we've already been mentioning the fact, you know, this is kind of a swarm army by default, although there are builds that don't use that quite as much. But if you don't like painting lots of little models with spindly bits, Tyranids will not be for you. But if you like the idea of having, if you just love painting models, and a lot of these guys can be painted really fast in batches.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, because, I mean, it, you're talking about, like, organic creatures. So, I mean, your color, but they're alien. So, like, your color possibilities are really just endless.
Yeah. And, yes, and because they're organic, washes work great with these guys.
Pick
a few base, you know, pick your, like, three base, like a base skin color, usually a chitinous shell color, and a weapon color. Maybe a paint in teeth if you want to paint those in. Apply a wash or two to give it depth and shading.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little bit of dry brushing if you want. And you'll have a painted Tyranid army in no time.
Yep.
And, you know, it may not be the prettiest, but being organic, they don't necessarily have to be the prettiest.
Yeah.
And if you want to go all out, you can do some really neat things. Like, there's some, like, with all the chitinous shell bits, edge highlighting can look really neat.
Right. Or kind of like an organic kind of stripe pattern.
Yeah.
I've seen good uses of those.
And then obviously with like some of the big things, like you've got the big Hive Tyrant, the big Carnifex, things like that, you can really go all out and make those almost like display pieces. You know, those are the centerpieces of your army. Put a lot of detail into those and have them really stand out. But use the same color scheme that you're using everywhere else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's really, you know, the limit on paint schemes is your imagination. And there are no bad colors. There are colors that they give you as kind of like, well, this is what this Hive Fleet's main coloration is, and this is what this Hive Fleet's main coloration is. But the great thing is also, because the fleets evolve and change as they meet different needs, like maybe on this planet your coloration is really bad, so you know it doesn't match the surrounding fauna or flora. So now, after a couple of generations, we're going to evolve to a slightly different paint, different color scheme. So you could use one of the existing Hive Fleet color schemes and then just tweak it one way or another and come up with something else on your own. Okay, so let's say you've built out your basic army. What are the other things you're really going to want to add to a Tyranid collection?
Pyrovores.
No. Definitely not.
Yeah, this is an army that does have a handful of absolute stinkers, and Pyrovores are one of them.
Yep.
It's a flame, supposed to be kind of like a super flamethrower unit, but it just doesn't work out that way.
Like, it was originally designed as a suicide unit that might suicide or not. It may just sit there and
die. If they feel like it.
If it just happens to explode, then hey, it explodes. So yeah, it's not good.
If it please the court, I will be exploding now. It does not please the court.
Okay. Oh, okay.
All right. Yeah. So it, I would say Tyrannocytes, your big organic drop pods are really useful. They can hold a unit up to 20 models. Or they can carry one monstrous creature.
Right.
Which is kind of neat.
Yeah, being able to drop in, oh, like a Tyrannifex or, you know, it's one Carnifex, not a whole brood, just one.
Right.
But kind of like how you can put one Dreadnought in a drop pod or take up to three now.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of their kits now are dual-purpose kits.
Yep. Yes.
So, like, we were talking about the Hive Guard earlier, that kit also makes Tyrant Guard.
Yes.
We've mentioned Venom Thropes, which are also a good add-on if you're going to be using a lot of little Griblies because they'll need cover. They are a three-pack unit or three pack kit or three model kit that can also make Zoanthropes.
Yes. Which are also quite useful for your anti-vehicle and also synapse support, since they are synapse creatures. The Tyrannocyte kit makes both the Tyrannocyte and the spore thing, the big spore thing.
That's the mucolid spore?
Yeah, the spore assist.
The spore assist. And the mucolid spore along with the spore assist.
Right, right.
The exocrine kit also makes the Har Specs. The Maliceptor kit makes Toxicrine. The Malloc kit makes a Trigon, I should say the Trigon kit makes a Malloc.
The Crone and Harpy kit.
Yep.
The same.
Crone, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We talked about the Hive Tyrant kit will also make you a Swarm Lord. The Carnifex kit stands alone. It only makes Carnifexes.
It only needs to, though.
Yeah.
Yes. And they actually do sell like a dual pack Carnifex brood that's two Carnifexes, which I think saves you like maybe like $5 or something.
Yeah, they're normally $53.75, and the Carnifex
90 brood, for two.
Yeah, so you do actually save money on.
Yeah,
you save about $10.
Yeah, yeah.
But that honestly, like after you pick up the Tyranid Swarm and the start collecting, like that Tyranid Brood might be a good next thing because then you just throw it in with the Carnifex you've got from your Swarm, and then you've got a unit of three, and
right.
You don't really have to change your force or gap any, but you're pumping more points into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then from there, I think it's just you pick the units that fit what you want to, where you want to go. You want to build flying? We'll start picking up those Hive Crone Harpy kits.
Right.
Maybe pick up a second one of these to have the gargoyles and another flying Hive Tyrant.
Yeah. Like take a look at like the formations in particular and think of any of those that you might want to run and look at filling those out. Like I know the Sky Blight Swarm, it is a little pricey on investment because it not only involves a winged Hive Tyrant and three units of gargoyles, but it also requires two harpies and a Hive Crone.
Mm.
So that's a lot of kits, but if you were buying two of these starter boxes and the swarm box, you've got the Hive Tyrant and you've got three units of gargoyles.
Yep.
So that just leaves you the Hive Crones, or the Hive Crone and the two Harpies,
which
are the same kit. So three of that kit makes that formation. And that formation is pretty awesome because whenever those gargoyle broods die, they have a chance of coming back on a 4+.
Right. And anything that can keep your army on the table in any way is always good.
Yes.
Yeah, so like I said, after that, it really is just hanging to spy. I think you're right. Going for formation targets, that's really what you want to do. And if you can't get the money to get the digital editions, there's always the Blood of Kittens formation compendium online.
Yes.
That will have all of these. There's a number of units that you may have noticed we haven't really talked much on. Things like lictors, gene stealers. I mean, the gene stealer is kind of like visually, it's one of those things that people think about when they think Tyranids, especially the idea of, the Tyranids borrowing a lot from like H.R. Giger as far as their design. Because, I mean, gene stealers were the enemy on Space Hulk, which is the, kind of, Space Marines meets alien, like xenomorph aliens hunting them down. But they don't, at least in this edition of the Codex and this edition of the game, they don't translate well to actually being effective on the table. Gene Stealers used to be a lot better. Lictors are okay, but hard to use.
The Lictors really need those formations to kind of get that leg up on being able to use them. There's not a ton of named characters in the book.
No, that's the Red Terror, Wold One Eye, and the Swarm Lord.
Yeah, and Death Leaper.
Oh, and Death Leaper, right? The named Lictor.
Yeah.
But that's also kind of their thing. It's this mostly faceless swarm. So
right, exactly.
It kind of works.
That's...
Well, and even in the fluffs, like, old One-Eye should have been long dead, but he keeps popping up right. with the same injury
yep.
on planets. There's no way he could have traveled between. And that's something that's in the Tyranid fluff is that they'll like, if you kill the Swarm Lord on one planet... It'll just grow a new one.
Right.
That has
right.
the memories of the old one.
And it's actually specifically called out in the Swarm Lord's fluff is that he has died a number of times before.
Mm-hmm.
And he just...
He got better.
Yeah, he got better. No, but his essence essentially is still like unique within like the Hive synaptic web. And it pretty much always gets reborn and keeps all of its memories and all of its tactical knowledge and just gets better each time he gets recreated.
He's basically Doomsday. Doomsday of the Tyranids.
Right.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
Yep.
I guess one thing I would say, like you guys mentioned the formations and stuff, and that's definitely a good way to go with it. The other thing I would say, this army in its current state more than some of the other armies, I would say, if you see a model that you think looks cool, go for it.
Except for the Power of War.
Well, I mean, but but even as such, yeah, the Power of Wars are just awful. But for the most part, if you really do like Gene Stealers,
yeah,
you're not going to make a tournament competitive Gene Stealer army. But it could still be a fun army to play, and it's to be a fun army to build and put together. So you're not at this point. You're not playing Tyranids to be hyper competitive, because there's so few builds that'll kind of allow you to do that.
Yeah,
I would say that if you're starting out, you know, go for things that you just like the models, like more so than some of the ones, because they are so visually aesthetically different than the other armies. If you see like, hey, I like the Moloch, pick one up and. You know, and paint it and put it together. So that just be aware that it's not going to be as useful as some other models in the army,
but not necessarily not useful.
Yeah, not, yeah.
And props to anybody who has taken Nids competitively and done well. It is not an easy army to play well, and especially because all your opponents are going to learn very quickly if they don't know already that they need to take out those linchpin units.
Yeah.
Although you can kind of mitigate that because there are units where like. I think like the Carnifexes, their instinctual, like if they fail their morale check and fall to instinctual behavior, well, they can't fail their morale check. They're fearless, aren't they?
They are, well.
Or they're.
Instinctual behavior is not a morale check.
Right? Or it's a leadership test.
It's a leadership test.
Okay, that's right. So it's.
So they can fail their instinctual behavior. The problem is they are fearless. So
they ignore
No, they have to. If it's a lone Carnifex by himself, he can ignore the worst result. It's Hunt that needs to be fearless.
Okay.
To ignore the worst result.
Okay.
But there are definitely ways of mitigating the downsides of the instinctual behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Like not running the brood of Carnifexes, but running a single Carnifex. By default, a Carnifex is fearless.
Right.
And if he fails his instinctual behavior, he's not going to get the bad result.
Right.
You know, the Tyrannifex is also a fearless, monstrous creature, and he has Hunt, so he will ignore the worst result on the instinctual behavior.
So there are ways to mitigate it.
Right.
Yeah.
Or you can, like, run a bunch of warriors.
Yeah.
You can try and spam in as much synapse as you can.
Which is one of the things about this Stark collecting box that is really nice, is that it gives you two sources of synapse right out of the gate.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Wait. I still am a big advocate of warriors. I know a lot of people don't like them because they can easily be doubled out. And lose that, you know, beefy, like, three wounds that they have from getting shot in the face with one missile. But, as I like to point out, that's a missile that didn't get shot at my Hive Tyrant.
Right.
If that's what they do.
That is true.
And the Hive Tyrant's probably going to get a lot more work done. And you don't have to worry about the warriors breaking because they're synapse and thus they're fearless.
Right.
Yep.
And just, like, a bare minimum like no upgrade unit of warriors is 90 points.
Yeah. And we were talking when we were planning this episode out of like how much we like I was easily able to get this up to like a 550 point like starter box.
Yeah. I actually went through and took the list of what's in that box and I added every upgrade that I could do all of the units and it was 701 points.
Nice. So hey, if you do that twice, you can get just over 1400 points.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, there you go. So obviously we've already mentioned that this is a fantastic deal as far as the individual kits. So I guess we'll kind of wrap this particular discussion up with, is this a good army for people to start out with?
I mean, to me, it kind of goes back to if you really like the aesthetic. If, you know, starting out, if you're not, I mean, because most people aren't going to start out as competitive players. You know, if you're brand new to the game, they're a very difficult army to start with. So I probably wouldn't recommend them in, like, as a brand new start army unless you're really drawn into the aesthetics. But they do have a lot of neat, interesting things that other armies don't have. So, I mean, when I first started 40K, that was kind of the decision I had to make was whether I wanted to go with Tau, which had like cool looking tanks and sleek armor, or Tyranids, which were this all, you know, living biomass, things like that. And both aesthetics did appeal to me, but I went with the Tau because that one, you know, was something I liked better. Less things to paint. But if you're somebody who likes painting, you're somebody who wants to get into that part of it and you like the aesthetic of the army, then yeah, I think it is, you know, it's a good place to go because you don't really get any other army that has that same feel that this one does.
Yeah. And when you're starting out, you're not going to really win those first games that much anyway.
It's
going
to take you a while to figure out what you're doing with the army. What about you, Richard? Would you say it's a good starting out army? If somebody feels drawn to it.
Yeah, if somebody is drawn to this, I think it is actually a very flavorful army to play. Mm-hmm. Like the models and the rules all kind of do a good job of representing like what the army is about, and it can be a really interesting, fun army to play. And in that respect, I can say that it might make a good starter army for somebody.
Well, we'll go ahead and wrap up this section of the show, and we'll come back next episode with a new start collecting, or, you know, so you want to start an army. I think we're looking at possibly Necrons next.
Yep.
Yeah.
That should be fun.
So we're jumping over the S's?
We're going to just jump around. We'll jump around.
Yeah.
Get up, get down.
Jump.
So we'll move on to wrap up the show with hobby progress. And if you've been following our Facebook page, you saw my hobby progress.
That looked like anti-progress.
It was retrograde progress. So it's been really cold lately here. But I wanted to get some progress. I wanted to get some painting done. I've been kind of sitting back and playing Star Wars Battlefront for a little while and not painting. So I was like, I'm going to break out my Chaos or break out my Nurgle Marines. I'm going to work on my Plague Marines. They're like halfway done. I should just, you know, get working on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too cold to work in my workshop right now, which is the garage. So I'm going to move some stuff out to the kitchen table. Now, our youngest dog was awake, but I had pushed everything away from the edge of the table. I figure he's a corgi. He can't reach that far and get anything. And I'm like, and I started getting set up and I realized, oh, wait, there's a color I need to get that I left in the garage. So I go to get it and I hear from my wife coming back from the kitchen, hey, he's got one of your figures. He's chewing it up really good. And so I ran in there, managed to salvage what I could out of his mouth. And because while I had pushed it far enough back, he like propped himself up on the chair to give himself some extra reach because he's a dick. To give you an idea how the day was with that dog. Okay, I love this guy. He is actually sweet, very energetic. You've all met him.
Oh, yeah.
All of you here on the show have met him. He's not even a year old. And that morning, he ran outside, like Like my daughter was we live like right behind the school, so my daughter was walking up to school, and the door, because it's cold, the hydraulics weren't closing as fast, and he bolted out after her. And there are people driving by trying to get up to this, you know, because they're also dropping people off at school, and so we tried to lure, you know, he followed my daughter up to school. And so I had to like run, you know, but you can't run after him because that'll just excite him more. So I'm going diverging on this story, but it just sets the scene for the day. So he kind of ran up and then he ran back to the house, but he didn't go up to the door. He ran like over to our side yard, grabbed an old bagel that my wife had put out for the birds, and was running around up to the schoolyard and back with this bagel in his mouth. Like, look at my prize. I'm so awesome. Finally got him cornered near the police station, which we also live right behind. But, get him cornered near the police station. He's like behind this row of like concrete blocks. And I come up to him, and he's like chomping on this bagel. I grab him by the collar because he's distracted enough. He's not moving. I go to put his leash on. That's when he decides to bite me on the hand.
Oh.
Terribly hard, but just enough just to, again, be a dick. So that he was already kind of on the shit list for the day. So he grabs one of my autocannon Havocs that I'd converted by like combining heavy bolters and the Reaper auto cannons from Defilers, and chews him the fuck up. A couple of pieces broke off along the glue lines, and fortunately, the auto cannon conversion was one of those. But the rest, his torso was mangled beyond belief. His legs were chewed in half. The backpack was chewed up. His head had come off and was whole. So I was able to repair the autocannon. I was able to salvage the 1.5 arms and the head. Fortunately, I had enough bits in my bits box to recreate the model. Mm. But he chewed up one of my Havocs, and that was bad enough. He also chewed the he also managed to get a hold of one of my fine cast Plague Marines, but he only got a little. He bit off part of the backpack and the plague blade.
Mm.
I was able to replace those with spare pieces. And then, so that was all the damage he did there. I am so glad he didn't get a hold of one of my Forge World Plague Marines.
Yeah.
There'd be one less dog. Well, no, I don't want to say that. I don't want to say that, but he
would have been in big trouble.
He would have been in huge trouble. So instead of getting a lot of painting progress done that night, I got a couple models repaired, started putting on brush on primer. So I've got more of that to do probably tomorrow night after he's put in his box for his crate for the night. So that was my hobby progress. I had to fix dog damage. And I just want to say, as I mentioned on the Facebook page, in 9 years of doing 40K, and having dogs that whole time, having corgis that entire time, I've never lost a model to a dog until that little asshole decided to break the streak that night. And all not because he thought it was tasty or anything. He just wanted to grab something and run off with it for attention.
Right.
Because obviously he doesn't get enough attention. Son of a bitch. Literally, son of a bitch. Son of a bitch. All right. So that's my progress.
I have not done anything. I've also been playing Battlefront and watching Force Awakens. That's really kind of been it. Work's been super busy, so I haven't had a lot of free time. Yeah, that's really kind of it. I went into like kind of hyper paint mode to get a bunch of stuff done for Renegade Open, and I haven't really
recovered from that.
Yeah, I just haven't gotten set back up. And like with the holidays and stuff, like where my hobby stuff is also where we store like all of our Christmas decorations. So all of that was kind of disturbed to get all that stuff out. And so I need to put all that back away and then get everything kind of reorganized. I've got to I want to reorganize all of my codexes as well and get them all in one place. And just kind of do some upkeep bookkeeping stuff before I actually get back into working on models. But we did get a couple of things put together for Midwest Conquest. So we've got a couple more kits for prize support, stuff like that, that I dug out that,
oh, great,
that we can donate. So that's coming along pretty well. And then we've got actually a planning meeting this weekend,
yes,
to go through and just see where we're at, discuss more on it. So, if anybody's still interested, obviously the information's still up on our website.
And we'll be talking a little bit more about that after we finish Hobby Progress too.
Well, I went on a gluing binge and kind of made a big dent in some of the backlog of jet bikes and stuff and some of the stuff I got from the holidays. So I now have my Crimson Hunter formation. So I've got three Crimson Hunters now. Put together more scatter bikes and shuriken cannon bikes and even put a few Warlocks and a couple Farseers together and did some conversions for a hybrid of my the old style Warlock that I was air quote using and the new bits from the Warlock kits. Cause I bought some of the, what I'd called the old style bikes that I saw at a friendly gaming store. But when I got them home, the interesting thing was instead of having the big bases, they had tiny bases, sort of like the new things, but they still had the little pin instead of the ball joint at the top of it. And I can use those and converted them with extra Warlock parts from when I made Farseers, because the Farseer Warlock kit's the same.
Right.
So, put on the Warlock head, put on the little Warlock decal, not decal, but the...
like the little targeting symbol thing.
And gave them the spears, because, well, singing spears are awesome. And made a whole kind of Seer Council on jet bikes.
Which is actually a really cool way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you also picked up some Army Painter spray primer to hopefully get them painted quickly.
I'm lazy, so I've got picked up some of the crimson red, or I guess dragon red Army Painter because it's crimson colored. And so I will now prime them, bottoms white, tops red, and then hopefully that'll be two of my three colors I need.
There you go.
I the only thing I really was able to get done, I was kind of collating and organizing and then have started putting together some stuff for our auction army.
Or which, and also that, just to be clear, it's a raffle army, not or,
Yes.
Yeah, same, just so that people know that raffle. We're not, yeah.
Right. Yes, yes, right. Raffle. Yes.
But yeah, so you've, and we've had another listener order a kit for us, so we are just about there on that, so we should be getting all the components. I think there's only like one or two kits left remaining, unless we want to start expanding upon it. But let's see where we are now and what we get together. I promised that we'd slowly be rolling out more info about what we're doing with the army. So last episode we announced that it is an orc army. This episode I will announce that it is an orc army of the Speed Freak variety. Lots of vehicles. In fact, the last kits that we have yet to get are a unit or two of war bikers. Yep. So those still remain to be acquired. But we have pretty much everything else for what we're going for.
Yep.
It's going to come in at about 1,000 points, I think.
Actually, I put together a list that I was able to find it at about 1,500.
Oh, okay. Actually. Good. So. Alrighty. So, okay.
So you have a range.
Yeah. Right. So depending on how you build it, 1,000 to 1,500 points. So a good starting spot for either a new orc player or an existing orc player that wants to pad out with something they might not already have. So, So that's what we'll tell you about the army right now. As far as where we're going with the Midwest Conquest, Richard was also awesome enough to get some posters put together.
Yes. Yeah.
So we're going to get those printed soon, and probably this weekend if I can. And soon we will be getting the shameless self-promotion tour where we will be touring game stores around the area and probably shipping some off to friends out in like up the frozen north, down in Oklahoma, out to the guys out in Wichita, and getting those up and around and start trying to gear up, get more people signing up. We've hit almost a quarter of our signups now. And granted, we've got 3-4 months at, we've got 3 more months of sign up available because we're going to cut off sign up on April 30th. But there's still time for us to fill that up. But Once we start hitting the local areas, we expect that to start filling up quicker and quicker and quicker. So it's still best to sign up now early while the spaces are available. And we're definitely starting to see a lot of players from out of town.
Yep.
Because we've got signups from our friends up in Minnesota. We've got them from Oklahoma. We got a sign up from Des Moines recently. Yeah. We've got people coming in from Illinois. So, and we've got some people from the local area as well. So we're going to be just, again, the sooner you sign up, the more likely you are to have a space. One of the things we're going to be doing at our planning meeting this weekend is probably finalizing some of our prize support. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be hopefully getting more as we hit local stores and discuss and see if we can get some prize support from them as well. And something I meant to talk about last episode and we didn't quite get to is the FAQ situation.
Oh, yes.
I wanted to mention this. So the Adepticon FAQ has come out. Obviously, the ITC FAQ has been out. There's a lot of things in those that we really like. There's a couple of rules decisions that we disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
In an attempt to get a rules set that is consistent with how we would rule the game, and our goal is to try to get it as close to as we feel rules as written are. Which admittedly puts us at odds with a little bit on the ITC side because they have decided to, just straight up rewrite rules for the way they feel better, is better balanced for the way they want to run their events. Adepticon has avoided that for the main point, but there's some rulings they've made that don't quite jibe with how the rules how we see the rules written. So we are going to basically be collating those, compiling those, and basically using those as a basis to build an FAQ for this event. This is still going to be an ITC event. I'm still completely on board with the mission of the ITC as far as having one tournament circuit, and there's nothing about the ITC that prevents us from using our own FAQ. That's straight up in their rules for an ITC event. You can use any or all or none of their rules. We're probably going to be, I mean, if you look at the ITC FAQ, we'll probably be using like 95% of their rules.
Right, yeah.
Because there's 95% we don't have any issue with. So we'll be compiling that soon. I'm hoping to have that up by like February 1st. I think we can, I mean, it, like I said, most of this we have no issue with. And there's just a few points that we
want to clarify, or we want to, you know,
clarify and also be consistent with like the way we've been ruling things on the show with like people's rules questions. And so again, thank you all for sending in these questions, because there's some things that like the grav weapons versus artillery from last episode that I don't think I haven't seen addressed in the ITCs. So these are the kinds of things that would be good to have kind of ready to go. Mm-hmm. So like I said, we're going to compile that. When we get it together, it'll be up on the Midwest Conquest page. We'll probably go ahead and share it on the Preferred Enemies page too, because it's going to be the FAQ that we will be using at any events we run locally, any events we run in the future.
And, you know, I mean, part of it's playtesting as well. If anybody wants to download that, use it for your events, let us know how it works out, what issues you've got.
Because
that helps us as well.
Yeah. Everyone gets better the more we discuss it and kind of, whereas I'll be honest here, this is not something that we would necessarily put up for a vote like the ITC. Mm-hmm. It is also something that we are perfectly willing to take feedback on. And if somebody can make a good argument as to why something should work one way or another way, it's definitely something, you know, that we will, like, you know, Richard coming back and saying, well, hey, the captain and chapter master thing may not work because of this and this. And it's like, oh, hey, that's something we had not considered when we made that ruling. Absolutely. Let's update the FAQ with that in mind. So, our goal is to have this as being kind of a living document, but one that, like, will, you know, for tournaments, like, we'll lock it down at certain times. So, like, we're going to hope to have this rolled out by February. I think hopefully by like 1st of April, it'll be locked in
for what
we're going to, you know, so you'll have 2 months of knowing exactly what we're going to have for Midwest Conquest. But again, as always, midwestconquest.com.
Yep.
You can sign up, or we've also got the Facebook page. You can go ahead and register there. In fact, I'm going to be in the next, hopefully, a couple of days, if I can find the time, putting together a nice, big, shiny register now button on the side. So it'll be really easy for everybody to find the link to register. And we'll get that out there. And as more information comes in on like prize support and the Raffle Army for Wounded Warrior Project, we'll get that information out there. And thank you to everyone who's written into us, and especially thanks to the handful of people who have contacted us and like straight up said, like, we're ordering kits for you to add to this. So you guys have all been awesome. We've got some of the best listeners, and I'm just so grateful to have everybody on board and helping us out with this, because we all make each other better when we all work together on this.
Absolutely.
So I think that just about wraps us up for the night. So, as I said, next episode, 119, we will be continuing with looking at, so you want to start an army, Necrons. And we'll also hopefully be getting the guys from the Flying Monkey GT on. I've contacted them again to see if they can join us on the air. I would love to have them on, because they were a great group of guys to shoot the shit with down in Oklahoma, late night over drinks. And so hope to have at least one of them on and talk to them about their upcoming event, because theirs is the first GT they're having in Wichita also. Yep. And that is coming up in the middle of April, I think April 15th, 16th, 17th, I want to say are the dates.
Okay, yeah.
And so that'll also be a kind of a good warm-up for jumping into to the Midwest Conquest. So we hope to have that together by then. So that'll wrap up the night. So from all of us here at Preferred Enemies, I'm Rob.
Kevin.
Dennis.
And Richard.
Good night, good gaming, and oh, go with the hive mind and get all the little gribblies and eat everything.
Preferred Enemies is an Under Gopher Radio production and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 Unported License. Our theme music is Metal Slug 2 Super Vehicle 001/2 No Need to Reload, originally by Takushi Hayamuda and remixed by Roataka, courtesy of OC Remix. It can be found at ocremix.com.